Thanks so much, Nick. The ceasefire with Iran is already in serious trouble. In fact, you could already say that it is broken down. Hours after the deal came into force, such as it is, Iran's Revolutionary Guards shut the Strait of Hormuz again. Tehran says it's retaliation for Israel's massive strikes on Lebanon, which killed at least 182 people. Perhaps a million now have been displaced. The White House calls the closure completely unacceptable and says the ceasefire itself is now on the line. Without getting all too epistemological about this, when is a ceasefire when none of the adherents to the ceasefire can even agree on what the ceasefire is? Lots more on the Iran war, on which we seem to be back to square one.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, President Trump says US forces in the Middle East will remain in place as the ceasefire appears increasingly fragile. Iran has called Israel's attacks on Lebanon a breach of terms, despite the US insisting it's excluded from the deal. Lebanese officials say airstrikes killed 182 people on Wednesday. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, told LBC's Nick Ferrari this morning she's extremely concerned by the escalation.
I think this escalation, I do think this is absolutely the wrong thing to do. I think this escalation by Israel yesterday is completely the wrong thing to do. We're seeing serious humanitarian consequences. We've already got the mass displacement of huge numbers of people in Lebanon. And then, of course, the number of deaths and injuries yesterday.
LBC has learned the Defence Secretary was spotted on a flight to the south of France last week despite rising tensions in the Middle East. The sighting of John Healey came after Donald Trump issued his threat to bomb Iran back to the Stone Ages. The Ministry of Defence has declined to say whether Mr. Healey was on holiday but says he chaired briefings over Easter. You can read more on the LBC app. French officials say four people have died after a small boat capsized in the English Channel. It's understood the vessel got into difficulties in the early hours of this morning. The Foreign Secretary has told LBC she won't comment on military details following reports that Russia sent a warship through the Channel. It's understood a Kremlin frigate accompanied two oil tankers along the south coast of England yesterday morning. That's despite Keir Starmer's threat to seize illegal ships funding the Ukraine war. Former Conservative Defence Minister Tobias Elwood has told us it should act as a wake-up call.
Russia is clearly enjoying testing us, mocking us, aware of how overstretched our armed forces are, including our surface fleet. I'm pleased that the laws have changed, that our special boat service and other SF capabilities can now board these shadow fleets. But ultimately, if you don't have the kit to do so, then the Russian forces can operate at will. And that's where we are at the moment.
Victims and bereaved families in England and Wales are to get more time to challenge sentences they believe are too lenient. The period will change to challenge an offender's punishment is to increase from 28 days to 6 months. Ministers say the current window is too short for those impacted by crime to engage with the justice system. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 29 at 10,588. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather. Spells of rain will push eastwards, but staying dry in the south. Rain clearing elsewhere to leave sunny spells by the afternoon. A high of 23 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Get 25% off coffee and pastries at Cafe Nero with Compresa Market. Take it away, Sergey.
I need a Nero. I'm holding out for a Nero to get a flat white. It's gotta be strong, and it's gotta taste good, and it's gonna be made just right. I need a Nero.
Only with the Compare the Market app, the simple way to save.
When you take out a qualifying product, one membership a year, 25% off barista-made drinks and pastries, app only, two codes per day, exclusions and T's and C's apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Well, a very good morning to you. 10:04, Thursday the 9th of April. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien all this week on LBC. And this Thursday morning, I'm bringing you Mystery Hour. No, not that one. When is a ceasefire not a ceasefire? What is a ceasefire when none of the main adherents to the ceasefire, the signatories to the ceasefire, can even agree on what the terms of the ceasefire were less than 24 hours after they were sort of signed. Because that is the situation in which we find ourselves this morning. Yesterday we were talking about a two-week, at least, cessation to the hostilities after 40 days of pretty futile, bloody war in Iran. A war of choice, at least in this iteration of it. And only 24 hours later, we're discussing whether that ceasefire is even in place. Because despite the fact that we were told by the Americans yesterday that the Iranians were on their knees pleading for a ceasefire, less than 24 hours later, they have closed once again the Strait of Hormuz over what Israel is doing in Lebanon. We had on paper a two-week ceasefire between the US and Iran. What was that deal that we were talking about only yesterday? That Iran would reopen the strait, that tiny stretch of water through which so many of our commodities and goods and crucially oil flows. The region steps back from the brink, except within hours, as I say, Iran closing it again. They say because Israel is still bombing Lebanon, mass airstrikes in Beirut, hundreds dead, a million displaced over the course of the conflict. And Israel says, and the US says, that particular bit of the war wasn't actually covered by the ceasefire. Iran says that it was covered by the ceasefire. This would be like Armistice Day in the First World War. And finally, you get the Allies and you get the Axis powers finally getting together in November 1918 and deciding that there's going to be an armistice. And then on the 12th of November, after the armistice was supposed to come into force in 1918, the Germans are also going, oh, no, this didn't cover what was going on in the Balkans. No, that didn't cover then. Sorry you misunderstood. Terribly sorry. But we're going to be continuing the fighting there. We just meant what was going on in the Western Front. There's only really two ways, as far as I can see, to look at it. Either it is gross and appalling incompetence, or someone is lying. And the question that I want to put to you this morning is, which side do we believe? Have a listen to our own Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, speaking to Nick Ferrari on RBC this morning. And it's quite telling, I think, just how strident she is about where she's putting some of the blame.
I'm extremely concerned about this. I think this escalation, I do think this is absolutely the wrong thing to do. I think this escalation by Israel yesterday is completely the wrong thing to do. We're seeing serious humanitarian consequences. We've already got the mass displacement of huge numbers of people in Lebanon. And then, of course, the number of deaths and injuries yesterday. I think this is the wrong thing to do for humanitarian consequences. It's also the wrong thing to do for stability across the region and security for Israel as well. We want to see this ceasefire extended to Lebanon. We want to see an end to hostilities in Lebanon urgently. It's extremely important that that happens.
Perhaps if we're trying to adjudicate exactly whether or not this ceasefire was supposed to apply to Lebanon, one arbiter to which we might look is Pakistan. Because, of course, Pakistan is the country which has been mediating over the course of this week and the last couple of days, trying to bring this ceasefire about. And it is, of course, worth noting that Islamabad strongly condemned Israel's strikes on Lebanon. Perhaps we might expect that, calling them a violation of international law and humanitarian principles, while simultaneously urging an immediate ceasefire everywhere. And Pakistan have said that their understanding was that the ceasefire would cover Lebanon, and the US and Israel in particular saying that it does not. So Pakistan, who are playing the role of the peacemaker here, saying that their understanding was that the ceasefire would extend to Lebanon, and Israel saying that this is a separate part of the conflict. Now, we might conclude and say that Iran, two things. We might say that Iran certainly acts entirely improperly in Lebanon. They back Hezbollah, they arm them to the teeth. It is absolutely true that Hezbollah have caused a nightmare in lots of different ways for Israelis living in northern Israel over many, many years. Absolutely, completely correct. But it's also true to say that you might think that if this ceasefire was so important and were to be hailed as Donald Trump was doing yesterday, that he might have just as a matter of competence, made sure that everybody understood precisely where and what the ceasefire applied to. Yet here we are this morning, apparently in a state where, as I say, either someone's lying about it or there is genuine confusion. There's a second part of this as well, which is that the fact that Iran has decided to block the strait again so readily and to renege on the ceasefire for whatever reason does rather put into question, doesn't it, all of the things we were being told just yesterday by the Americans, A, about just how much Iran had been completely militarily eviscerated, and B, just how desperate they were for a ceasefire. Here's just a reminder of what Mr. Two Jacket Sizes Too Small Pete Hegseth was saying about it yesterday.
President Trump forged this moment. Iran begged for this ceasefire, and we all know it. As the president truthed this morning, a big day for world peace. Iran wants it to happen. They've had enough.
Well, he wasn't entirely wrong. It was a big day for world peace. Just the one. There he was, Pete Hegseth there, with his hair completely and utterly swamped in brio, deciding that and saying that Iran was begging for a deal, begging for a ceasefire because it had been brought to its knees. Well, if that were the case, if it were the case that America had so completely vanquished Iran and achieved all of its military objectives, then surely it stands to reason that Iran would not be so reckless or feckless or frankly brave to decide to rip up that agreement on, what, not even a full day later. It makes no sense. Once again, someone is lying to us. And I do think we should just take a step back for a moment. And it's a bit glib, I suppose, at this point. It's been remarked upon before. But I say it again, I think it is worth saying. The very fact we're even having this conversation, the very fact that I need your help to try and sort of pass through this a little bit, because it feels a little bit postmodern. I'm not sure what the answer is here. I'm not sure who's telling the truth. I'm not sure exactly where the balance of truth lies, because it always is a balance. It's not always, of course, absolute. But the very fact that I don't take it reasonably as read, that the American account is more or less on the money, I think tells us so much. The fact that at times in this conflict we have had to look to the theocratic monstrosity that is the government, the regime of Iran, to shed some light and cast some light on the truth of events does tell us something, doesn't it, about the tenor of the American administration with which we are now dealing, because they are so bombastic, and not just bombastic or chauvinist or jingoistic, but they are so often living in their own parallel slipstream of reality, i.e. whatever is going on in Donald Trump's rather withered cerebellum, that at that point, given the whole of the administration has to live in that fantasy land, we just can't look to it for anything. We can't look to it for any semblance of truth. We can't look to it for any actual reasonable accuracy, because it's always a, you know, states always lie a bit, they always mislead a bit, they always say exactly what they want to say. But even a modicum of truth and accuracy tells us so much. The fact that this has become a relativistic question between this shining democracy on which we could at least rely for some anchoring of stability in the world. I said anchoring of stability in the world. And the fact that there is now a sort of relativistic scale between that and the theocratic monstrosity of Iran, as I say, is shocking. And so what I want to ask you this morning is exactly, what account do we believe on this? 0345 6060973. Who do we believe when the Israelis in the US say that this ceasefire never ever applied to Lebanon in the first place, and actually that was a completely separate sphere? Or do we believe the Iranians who say it always was supposed to apply to Lebanon? And the fact that the Israelis continued and in fact intensified with the worst attacks that we've seen so far in southern Lebanon, that in fact that meant that they were breaking the ceasefire. Who broke the ceasefire? Which part of the ceasefire and which version of the ceasefire do we actually believe? And here's just a reminder of what's been going on in southern Lebanon, because I think it is one of those things that has been somewhat, and I think shockingly, ignored, partly just because events elsewhere have been so astounding and so rapid in terms of their developments. In the past 24 to 48 hours alone, Israel has launched one of the heaviest waves of airstrikes of the war. So that is during the so-called ceasefire, hitting Beirut, the Bekaa Valley, southern Lebanon, coordinated attacks on what they say are Hezbollah targets, but they are in densely populated areas. The death toll from these latest strikes is in the low hundreds, roughly 180 to 250 killed, many more injured, hospitals there overwhelmed, and it comes on top of a wider conflict that has already seen more than 1,500 people in Lebanon and displaced, killed, and a million people, more or less, displaced. A million people in a tiny sliver of a country, which itself, of course, over the past 15 years has absorbed an enormous number of refugees, roughly a quarter of its population, not least from Syria. Civilian infrastructure has been hit, residential buildings destroyed, emergency services under severe strain again. Israel's stated aim, of course, is to degrade and neutralize Hezbollah's military capability, its missile stockpiles and command networks. But critics clearly argue that the scale of this bombardment is risking a worsening instability without delivering any lasting security. How many times have we been here before? I remember back in 2006 when I was just a student, I remember Tony Blair's government getting in enormous trouble. People forget this now. One of the reasons he ended up resigning was because Israel was absolutely slamming southern Lebanon and Hezbollah targets, causing all sorts of civilian casualties along the way. Blair refused to condemn it, and it partly led to his removal and Gordon Brown replacing him. But here we are again. Well, that's 20 years ago, and we're playing the same old song. And now the conflict in Lebanon, between Lebanon and Israel, between Hezbollah and Israel, is apparently the cause, once again, of this continued instability in Iran. Who do we believe? Is it Iran or is it the United States? Who has broken the terms of this ceasefire and what should we do now? And the fact that I'm even asking that question, and I ask it with no relish whatsoever, as a firm Atlanticist all my life, someone who loves the United States, huge aficionado and obsessive about American politics, I've lived and worked in the United States, I love it. But the very fact that I'm having to ask you to help me understand who has broken the terms of this ceasefire and which government, which administration, which regime we are to believe, the US or Iran, I think tells its own tale, doesn't it? 0345-60-60973, 0345-60-60973. You could, of course, WhatsApp on the same number, text 84850. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien here on LBC. The time is just approaching 10:17.
LBC. At Wickes, the Home and Garden event is now on. Save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £24, now £16. Shop today. Terms apply.
Do you ever feel like getting back under your duvet in the middle of the day? Ferroglobin is a great-tasting liquid formula with iron, which contributes to the reduction of tiredness and fatigue and normal formation of haemoglobin. Ferroglobin from Vitabiotics. At Boots, pharmacies, and vitabiotics.com.
Cancer doesn't care about childhood. It doesn't care what they miss out on or how much you want to protect them. But we do. At Great Ormond Street Hospital Charity, we fund life-saving research, vital family support, and the special things that help seriously ill kids be kids. Until no childhood is lost to cancer. Join us. Search GOSH Charity.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345-60-60973.
Time is 10:18. Let's kick off today's show, shall we, with Sam in Guildford. Sam, you're Lebanese, I understand.
Hi, Lewis. Yes, I am Lebanese.
And so you have still got family there?
Yes, both of my parents still live in Lebanon.
Gosh, are they in southern Lebanon?
No, they're not. They're in northern part of Beirut, so they're in a safe area.
Although Beirut itself, of course, has come under heavy attack.
Yeah, it has. So the reason, that's why I'm going to answer your question. So the question is very valid. Who should we believe? And I think we shouldn't believe the U.S. or Israel, or we shouldn't believe Iran, but we should believe the ones that brokered the deal. Mm. And if the prime minister of Pakistan said that Lebanon is included, if the ambassador of Pakistan to the U.S. said that Lebanon was included, then I think you have your answer there. Like, it's clear that Lebanon was included. It's clear that Israel didn't like the outcome of the deal that the U.S. brokered at the last minute, and that's why they're lashing out.
I think, I mean, obviously there is a tale that we can tell about this war, of course, which is that, and of course, this isn't, I don't think we can say this is a conspiracy or anything like that, because we heard it from Marco Rubio himself at the start of the war, right? Which was basically that the Israelis were going to launch an attack on Iran anyway, and the Americans were sort of trundled into it. I mean, if it is the case that the Israelis, and we were reporting on the show yesterday, were pretty ambiguous about whether or not they thought that it included Lebanon. I mean, if it's the case that Israel had ploughed on ahead with this anyway and basically sort of forced the Americans again into a position, I mean, once again, it's an extraordinary story, isn't it, of Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli tail wagging the American dog.
Yeah, it is clear that that is the case. And plus, like, the narrative that they have about bombing, like, Lebanon, for those that you, that the listeners that don't know, there's 35% of the population of Lebanon that is Christian. I am Christian, and I lived in Lebanon for 25 years.
It's one of the most, so, it's one of the most religiously mixed countries in the Middle East.
It is a mixed country, and it's not true. Like, everyone likes to portray it, even if they don't blatantly say it, as, well, Israel is just bombing Muslims in Lebanon, and they're doing so because of this whole civilization war between Judeo-Christian belief and Muslims. Well, I would like the listeners to know that on the 9th of March, a priest in southern Lebanon was killed along with his deacon, and the Pope mourned him on the 11th of March. And this is public news. Everyone knows about it. And he was killed while trying to save other parishes, members of his parish, whose house was bombed by a tank. And it's all over the news in the Middle East. But when I just Googled it now before calling you, it was never on the BBC or any of the Western media news. And that's a priest in southern Lebanon that was killed. So it's not true that it's a war of civilization, and what they like to keep telling about the Muslims trying to attack Europe and the Judeo-Christian beliefs that it was built in. I was Christian. I don't believe in bombing civilians. I don't believe in killing 200 Lebanese people yesterday in buildings, high-rise buildings in Lebanon. What, were the missiles hidden in the 12th floor of the building? Do they take down the missiles in the elevator to bomb? It doesn't make any sense. People who know Lebanon, who've lived there, know that the areas that they attacked are not areas where Hezbollah operates from. But it's civilian areas that they just bombed because they're lashing out because they know that they can't continue with the wars with Iran because of the, what the U.S. did.
But it is true, isn't it, Sam, that Hezbollah, whatever Israel has done over the years, Hezbollah doesn't just oppose Israel. It opposes Israel for existing and the reason that Israel exists. And it is true to say as well that Hezbollah are deeply embedded in southern Lebanon and over the years have proved a security threat to Israel. So in that, we can certainly agree that what they are doing might be disproportionate and wrong, but nonetheless, Hezbollah is a threat to them that they do have a right to be concerned about.
All right. And Lewis, what does make Hezbollah a terrorist is the fact that he's attacking civilians, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that equate with... So if Hezbollah fires a missile at Israel and it kills a person in Israel, a civilian, an innocent person, that's a problem. But if Israel kills 180 people, civilians, by everyone's admission, that's not a problem. That's just them trying to kill the Hezbollah operative.
I've got to put just Sam, what Israel say, just for the sake of fairness. Yeah. Israel say that what Hezbollah do is that they concentrate themselves in civilian areas and that they do everything they can to try and avoid civilian deaths. Yeah. But if Hezbollah do that, then that's their choice.
I'm sure that's what they say. It's the same that the U.S. said about the Iranians getting a Tomahawk missile and bombing their own school where 170 girls died. That's exactly what
President
Trump said.
I think that's slightly different. I think that in the end, the Americans have said, ended up was a mistake on the basis of
false intelligence.
At the end,
but didn't Trump say initially that it wasn't them and it was the Iranians that bombed themselves?
Yes, they did. They did initially,
exactly.
Yeah. Great. Do you think, though, Sam, just in terms of, I mean, maybe, are we sort of jumping the gun, as it were, in a sense? Is there a possibility that, you know, yes, the Israelis are sort of trying to do what they can get away with, but at some point today, it's clear that the Trump administration want this ceasefire. You know, contrary to what they were saying yesterday, it was them who were closer to begging for it than Iran. And that, therefore, it's quite likely today that Trump at some point phones up Netanyahu and says, you better stop this right now because I want this ceasefire. I mean, actually, maybe by this time tomorrow, we'll be kind of back to where we thought we were this time yesterday.
Well, I am hoping that that will be the case. Like, we're all, like, Europe is the one that's suffered the most and that's going to suffer the most from all the rise in inflation. Our mortgages are going to go up here. Everything has to do with the war. And everyone wants to see it stop, but it's not fair to stop the war and then keep hitting Lebanon. So, yes, I would want the Iranians to hold the Strait of Hormuz closed until the actual deal that was agreed. Yes, of course, until the actual deal that was agreed on.
Even though that's illegal. Even though that's illegal.
It is illegal, but it is also illegal to kill 200 people in Beirut yesterday.
Sam is in Guildford. Tom is in Maidstone. Tom, your views on this?
Hi, Luke. Good morning. First of all, just following up on what Sam said, it has been widely reported in Israeli news about the sad case of the priest. The IDF have claimed responsibility and apologized for what had happened. I appreciate it might not have been reported here, but it was definitely reported there.
I wasn't familiar with it, so
sorry.
I'm grateful for you to clarifying that. Yeah.
Now, there's a lot to unpick here, so I'll try to be coherent.
Please.
There's been plenty of ceasefires over the years. Most two recent ones I can remember, Resolution 1701, which Hezbollah did not adhere to. As of most recently, after the 12-day war or thereabouts, the Lebanese government was meant to essentially de-arm Hezbollah. And they were still not able to do that either. And yes, I know the Iranians are talking big right now and they allegedly reclosed the Strait of Hormuz. But the fact is that it's been reported that even though all the rhetoric, and everyone's got rhetoric, they are still attending Islamabad tonight for the negotiations.
Well, of course, Tom, just on the point of information there, when you talk about Resolution 1701, I mean, this just, you know, most of the audience won't be familiar with it. This was the UN Security Council, which ended the war that I mentioned in 2006.
Yes.
I mean, it is absolutely true to say Hezbollah didn't disarm as they were supposed to and so on. But it, also, they would say, Hezbollah have argued, that the Israelis violated it because they continue to have regular airspace incursions over Lebanon, strikes inside Lebanese territory. And the UN themselves have repeatedly said that Israel, along with Hezbollah, haven't adhered to the resolution. So it's
a bit
of both. Well,
two points on that. I think you were all too familiar with reports of how far the Hezbollah, not Hamas, Hezbollah tunnels came close to Israel borders. Mm-hmm. That was well observed. And secondly, if the UN, if France for that matter, Macron and Yvette Cooper are so concerned about the state of Lebanon, and they should be, why aren't they doing it to stop Hezbollah? Why is it only aggressive when Israel do something?
Because I suppose the point is, isn't it, is that Israel have decided to launch this massive incursion over the last 24 hours or so, which has derailed this ceasefire. So they have to kind of deal with one thing at a time.
Well, I don't, again, based on whose reports you listened to, apparently it was not part of the deal. Some say it was part of the deal.
Pakistanis say it was part of the deal and they mediated it.
Okay, well, again, Trump and Vance said something completely different. And I'm not saying they're right here. Mm. I'm just saying I don't think anyone right now is being honest with their truth and everyone's sort of assuming the rhetoric and the position that suits them at that moment.
I mean, wouldn't it be better off if everyone just put down their guns and then we can try and start talking? And if it is true that Hezbollah decide to take advantage of that by attacking northern Israel, then clearly Israel would have a right to defend itself. But until Israel actually does give peace a chance, to use that cliche phrase, then we're not going to get anywhere, are we?
You're right. But I'll just say that one thing, just to conclude. At the moment, the ceasefire is holding between America and Iran in that sort of part of the Gulf. Israel and Hezbollah since all to today have been firing rockets into Israel. So I think at the same time, Hezbollah and Israel are, I guess, inverted brackets, okay to carry on this between them and let sort of the bigger players perhaps have this.
But that's not, but just quickly, Tom, but that's not, because the Iranians are saying that they see it as part of the same war, and that's why they've closed the strait. So we might prefer that, although lots of people wouldn't, because they don't want to see Lebanese civilians being killed, or Israeli civilians for that matter. But given that's what the Iranians think, that's where we are.
It is, but it's not necessarily the fact. But again, I said, we just don't know.
All right. Tom in Maidstone there. I think we do know some things. Yoni is in Rochester. Yoni, good morning.
Good morning, just down the road, actually. I'm in the usual position where a lot of what I actually wanted to say has already been said, but I'll still give my...
Well, let's just imagine that the whole audience has just tuned in, Yoni, and we'll just ignore that.
The core point I think that I was going to make is that we can't trust the American word for it, because Donald Trump is clearly very sensitive to failure. You know, he doesn't like losing, and his view of the world seems to be somewhat skewed compared to reality. And Iran is noticeably unreliable for giving accurate statements on much of anything. And frankly, Israel at the moment is motivated to present a particular view of the world, more so than usual. So I am inclined to agree that Pakistan is probably the source we should be using when we are unclear on what's happened. And if they say Lebanon was included, I'm inclined to believe them.
Well, I mean, I suppose insofar as we've got a neutral observer, quite literally with regards to this, I mean, that is our best hope. I suppose then the question becomes, if that's the case, then there's only sort of two other conclusions, isn't there? Which is that, well, three, I suppose. One is that the Americans didn't really expect it to be adhered to anyway and just thought that they could sort of, you know, allow the Israelis to do what they wanted. Two is that the Trump administration is incompetent and actually didn't really understand what he had signed up to. Or maybe, I suppose, that the terms were a bit more nebulous than they've appeared. Or three, that the Trump administration didn't really bring the Israelis properly on board, and they're just deciding to take advantage of the sort of last moment and inflict as much damage on Hezbollah as they can.
I believe it's a mix of two and three.
Yes.
I can well believe that Trump was banging a desk somewhere going, just get them to stop shooting. And his team did their best to get a deal, any deal, on the desk so he could claim he's got a peace deal. But I also believe, given how much coordination Trump engaged in at the start of all of this, that he barely told the Israelis anything. And he may have just phoned them up and said, look, we've got a peace deal, stop shooting Lebanon. And Netanyahu went, sure, absolutely, we'll do that. Or maybe he was honest. Who knows?
Just to be absolutely clear, officials in Pakistan, including statements linked to Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, have described the deal they helped broker as a broad regional ceasefire, not just a narrow US-Iran arrangement. In their framing, that includes all Iran-aligned theatres, which must implicitly mean Hezbollah in Lebanon. So they may not have been absolutely explicit about it, but that is the clear indication of what they've said.
And I can well believe that Israel took one look at that and thought, well, I mean, we're still going to get shot at by people over there, so we should probably shoot them first. I can understand that. I would
just doesn't
be
get us very far, though, does it, in the end?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to understand exactly who shot first. But at the end of the day, your earlier point is true. At some point, everyone is going to sit on a table and sort this out. It really would be better if that was sooner rather than later.
Well, I think we can all agree on that. Yoni, who is in Rochester. Well, after the news, we're going to be talking to Alex Gandler, who is a spokesperson for the Israeli embassy in London, try and get some sense of what the state of play is as the Israeli government understands it. That is coming up. Your time has just turned 10:32. Let's take a breather and get the latest LBC News headlines with Dominic Ellis.
President Trump says US forces will remain in place in the Middle East as concerns grow the ceasefire deal could collapse. Iran has called Israel's attacks on Lebanon a breach, despite the US insisting it's excluded from the deal. LBC has learned the Defence Secretary John Healey was spotted on a flight to the south of France last week despite rising tensions in the Middle East. The sighting came after President Trump issued his threat to bomb Iran's critical civilian infrastructure just before Easter. And French officials say four people have died after a small boat capsized in the English Channel. Officials say 30 others were rescued when the vessel got into difficulties earlier this morning. LBC weather. Spells of rain pushing eastwards but staying dry in the south. Rain will clear elsewhere to leave sunny spells, a high of 23 degrees.
This is LBC.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the sports media industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Niamh, a sports media student in year 12.
During class, I've edited football videos for socials, reported on games, and even produced my own highlight packages. Working directly with the industry makes me excited for my future career in sports broadcasting.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Here's a bright idea. Let Wix see how much you could save on your electricity bills. With Wix Solar, our team handles everything under the sun, from design to the perfect installation of your solar panels. We're proud as a peacock to be rated excellent on Trustpilot, so you can feel confident your solar installation is in safe hands. Book your free solar appointment today at wix.co.uk. Wix Solar, a name you can trust with service you can rely on.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1 or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
How about Specsave ears?
Not sure.
Do you get it? Specsave ears?
Yeah, but no.
Oh, okay. Specs, and we also do hearing two savers.
Think about it. Should have gone to Specs and we also do hearing two savers. Can't see it catching on.
Okay, so we're saying Specsavers do eyes and ears. Senses savers.
Technically true.
Yeah.
But actually terrible.
Oh.
At Specsavers, we're hearing experts too, and have been for over 20 years.
Oh, should we just stick to Specsavers then?
Yeah.
Book a free hearing check today.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Time is 10:35. I can see the EU's Foreign Affairs Chief Kaja Kallas has said that in the EU's view, the ceasefire ought to include Lebanon. Well, let's turn now to Alex Gandler, who's a spokesperson for the Israeli embassy in London. Mr. Gandler, thanks so much for joining us and nice to talk to you again. What is Israel's understanding? Let me be absolutely clear. Israel's understanding yesterday was that you were told, that your government was told, that this ceasefire did not include Lebanon.
Yes, absolutely. And it was told not only to us, but to everyone else. You probably saw statements coming out of the United States as well. And shalom, Lewis. I'm sorry. Started off pretty strong, but strong question.
That's quite all right. That's fine. In which case, why is it that the Pakistanis, who, of course, as you know, mediated the deal, that they've indicated that this was a broad regional ceasefire? That's from the Prime Minister's office, Prime Minister Sharif's office, and not just a narrow US-Iran arrangement. I mean, surely if we're to believe anyone, it would be the neutral arbiters who mediated the ceasefire.
Well, if you are to believe anyone, you should believe the parties involved, the parties in question.
Well, then we'd believe no one because you both disagree.
Well, we said from the get-go, right from the beginning, that Lebanon is not part of this ceasefire agreement that was signed between the United States and Iran. Israel's interest in Lebanon is to stop Hezbollah from firing at our civilians in the north of Israel. Listen, Hezbollah has taken both the citizens of Israel and the citizens of Lebanon and hostage with their brutality, with shooting rockets at Israeli civilians, actually without provocation. There was a war with Iran. They could have stayed out of it, like many others have done. They didn't. It's not just us in Israel who are saying that they should stop. Even the people of Lebanon are saying they should stop. And they're saying that they should disarm, and they're saying that should dissolve and go back to Iran, to their handlers with the IRGC.
What if the Iranians were to say that they would make clear to Hezbollah, who are, of course, their proxies, if they were to make clear to Hezbollah that any attacks on northern Israel must stop immediately? But, of course, in return, that means that your government must stop attacking them. Would that not be a reasonable way to at least start the process of achieving peace?
Really? Lewis, I think you've been cognizant enough to see that Hezbollah, even if it stops for a couple of months, it's just rebuilding itself to start it all over again.
So you're not willing, your government's not, but you'll see, Mr. Gandler, that surely if there is to be any, you've been fighting on and off with Hezbollah for decades. You had the war in 2006. We keep repeating this endless cycle where you attack them, they attack you, it never ever stops. Would it not just be worth, just for a couple of weeks, having a cessation while there is an attempt to achieve a broader regional peace? That's just not worth a shot at all.
You know, after October 7th, Israel and Israeli people have went through a deep reckoning of what happened in the last several decades and what should happen forward. And we have an understanding within ourselves that this must end now and for all. This explains the last 3 years, if you look at it from that perspective.
Do you honestly think you're going to be able to stop Hezbollah, or Hamas for that matter, down the barrel of a gun? Don't you think you have tested that theory to absolute destruction? And actually, the collateral damage of you endlessly, ad infinitum, doing Einstein's definition of insanity, of repeating the same thing again and again and hoping for a different result, is not only the endless casualties of Lebanese or Gazans, but your own citizens.
It must come always with a political and diplomatic solution. There's no doubt about it. But you can't be naive to think that an organization or organizations that have the sword in their arm as their reason for existing, such as Hezbollah, such as Hamas, such as the Houthis, that they will ever stop killing our people, be it in Israel or abroad. There is no other way. You need to understand that the region we live in, unfortunately, acts in a different way than a European city. It's surrounded by people that do want us harm on a very aggressive and a very proactive way.
I do understand that, Mr. Gunner. I do. And I have obviously enormous sympathy for your citizens who have lived under the threat of Hezbollah fire and Hezbollah rockets for many years. But my contention to you is that you do them no favours, those citizens, by continuing this endless cycle of violence that in the end might buy you tactical peace but never buys you strategic ever security. And you must understand, surely, that this is an opportunity, could be an opportunity. Your government is once again plunging the wider world into a profound instability, and that surely it would be worth giving this 2-week period an opportunity to see if a wider peace can be achieved. And all that requires of your government is to stop the fighting for 14 days.
There are two parts to this. One, you should understand that our citizens, the citizens of Israel, we have a responsibility to them, and they have expectations from us as well, from the state that is. And the expectation is for us to take the fight to the enemy and not be ducks sitting there to be slaughtered. That is one. The second thing is this prescribed or this thought of stability that people have been living in. And the further you are from the region, the more stable you feel. Obviously, here in London, you feel more stable than a person living in Beirut or in Jerusalem or in Cairo.
The whole world, Mr. Gandler, is being destabilized and affected by the fact that your government, either because it never included this, was never included in the ceasefire, this particular bit of the conflict, or otherwise, is choosing to continue the war in southern Lebanon, which means that this ceasefire is no longer a ceasefire.
Well, there was never a ceasefire with Lebanon. We're getting besides the point, but what I am saying is that this perceived stability that you've been living in, we haven't felt it. We have been living in this instability that was caused not by the Israeli government, by Hezbollah, by terrorist organization, by non-state actors within the region, such as ISIS and others, for decades.
A million people, it is estimated, have been displaced in southern Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Now, by definition, those people are not all Hezbollah. The vast majority are going to be innocent civilians. Are you really saying that there was no other way for Israel to achieve its security aims than displacing a million people, having, of course, displaced millions in Gaza?
By international humanitarian law, which we vehemently try to work with, we must warn civilians before we're bombing areas. We have warned people in southern Lebanon because Hezbollah has turned southern Lebanon into a bastion of terror. They're not using bases. There are no terror bases in southern Lebanon. There are no Hezbollah barracks. It's all happening within civilian population. Hezbollah has been specifically using those areas in order to attack Israel, to prepare for attack.
You're saying, Mr. Gandler, that there is no other way of achieving your security aims other than displacing a million people, and indeed launching missile attacks on heavily, densely populated areas of Beirut, which is far from the Israeli border.
Well, there were ways, and we actually tried to do them after our first skirmish with Hezbollah last year. We asked for the Lebanese government to dismantle Hezbollah, and they've promised us they've done so. Unfortunately, their promises to drive Hezbollah north of the Litani River, which is the southern part of Lebanon, They promised us they did it. They showed proofs that they have dismantled Hezbollah military structure within southern Lebanon. Unfortunately, what we found out is that they completely failed. Completely not only failed, but lied. The situation in Lebanon, and I'm sure if you speak to Lebanese and they're truthful to you, they'll say Hezbollah is controlling everything with an iron grip. The Lebanese army and the Lebanese military are unable to control the country, and basically Lebanon has become an ungoverned country or governed by Hezbollah.
Very hard for it, Mr. Gandler, of course, for it to be a governed country when, on a repeated basis, your country is slamming it with missiles and attacks.
Your finger is directed in the wrong direction. It is Iran who's controlling Lebanon.
When does Israel ever take responsibility for its actions, Mr. Gandler? When is Israel ever going to take some responsibility for its actions and maybe ask itself the question as to whether it is doing not only the right thing for the world, but the right thing for itself and its own security? Because I just say again, we keep going around and around and around this endless cycle of violence, which never gets us and never gets you or your citizens anywhere closer to what you say you desire, which is security. At what point would you say, do you understand why some people looking at this just look at a state and stop seeing a state that, you know, used to be admired for all sorts of reasons as a beacon of democracy in the Middle East, and instead of seeing a country which is acting its self-defense, it starts to look, some people might say, as if you are doling out collective punishment?
I'm sorry that I'm sorry that some people might see it that way, but Israel is always trying to defend itself and its citizens. It is still a beacon of democracy in a very, very troubled area. Unfortunately, you know, from countries that have had peace for more than 70 years, it's hard to see the realities of war, but unfortunately we see war happening in Israel. And, you know, it's a bit short-sighted not to see the long-term goals of this, unfortunately, 3 years of war that started on October 7th with Hamas attacking Southern Israel.
Your fight with Lebanon, Mr. Gandler, has been going on for 20 years, if not longer than that, 30 years, and you're still in the same position. So is that not the long-term position we ought to be looking at? Which is, as I say, you're getting nowhere.
For a very long time, from 2006, a war that I participated in as a soldier until not that long ago, we didn't have war with Lebanon. We really didn't. We withdrew from Lebanon in 1999. There was no reason for us to have a war with Lebanon, and there isn't. We have quiet borders with our other neighbors in Egypt and in Jordan. In Lebanon, it's Iran and the IRGC and Hezbollah who are destabilizing that country and the region itself. You need to understand it, and you need to look at it from that prism.
And I do understand. I mean, Hezbollah is an appalling force, and they abhor your country, and I understand your security needs. My contention to you, Mr. Gandler, is that your country and your government's actions are actually destabilizing and undermine those security needs. One just last question, because I know you've got to go. Is it your government's position? There is nothing that would make you agree to the demands from, we've seen it from the British government, European governments, other governments around the world. There is nothing that would make you minded to have a cessation in the fighting in Lebanon just for this 2 week period. As far as you're concerned, this ceasefire cannot and must never apply to southern Lebanon, full stop.
This cessation of fighting, or, you know what, the beginning, let's look at the beginning of the war on the second day of the operation with Iran. When Hezbollah fired its rockets, I think that dropped the ball for all Israelis, including this government, that we must take care of this problem once and for all, because no one else is going to do it. Everyone else has failed every single time, be it UNIFIL, with European forces that were stationed on the border for more than 20 years since 2006. They have completely failed to stop Hezbollah. Actually, a lot of Hezbollah firing positions were next to UNIFIL bases. Was it the Lebanese government that completely failed with its dismantling of Hezbollah? The Lebanese society itself is asking for it, and we understand that we must take care of it once and for all. Now, we're listening to our European partners, obviously. There is a constructive conversation, but it's wider than these short-sighted thoughts of, well, let's make just a quick stop. Don't worry. We'll just stop for a second. There is a longer-term goal for people in Israel, and something that is much closer to home than it is for people here in Europe.
Alex Ganler, spokesperson for the Israeli Embassy in London. They're grateful for your time. Mr. Ganler, I want your views on what you've heard there. Are you persuaded? Do you think that the Israelis have a point in saying that the conflict in southern Lebanon should not be part of the ceasefire for their own security purposes? Which side of this latest war, which is the war over the ceasefire, do you believe? 0345-6060-973, 0345-6060-973. Time, 10:49.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
What has this war achieved? It degraded Iran's military capabilities. It may have degraded their abilities to enrich uranium for military purposes. But now that the fighting is apparently over, at least paused for 2 weeks, in some senses the real battle is beginning, certainly in trade terms, and Iran seems to be in the driving seat here. They're doing something that they hadn't done before in charging pay-to-play for ships in the Hormuz. Is that complete victory, as the president says? Can't be, can it?
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK, so we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
At Wickes, the Home and Garden event is now on. Save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £24, now £16. Shop today. Terms apply.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper, to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato, and spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify, pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah!
Chase is the digital bank that gives you 1% cash back on groceries.
So, can I get cash back on cake mix?
Indeed.
And icing?
Yep.
And sprinkles?
Sure.
And candles?
Yeah, and you can turn all that cash back into a nice birthday treat.
How do you know it's my birthday?
Just a hunch. Get 1% cash back on groceries, fuel and everyday transport when you spend with Chase. Search Chase Bank. 18 plus UK residents. 1% cash back on this debit card spending for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Eligibility and exceptions apply. May be changed or withdrawn.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's
weight loss.
Weight loss?
Forget that. You just
keep dancing.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress. MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, lower fat diet. Always read the label.
At Pets in a Pickle, we know your furry friends get up to all kinds of mischief. Like when the dog scuffed that entire chocolate cake. All the time the cat tested his 9 lives from the curtain rail. Again. That's why we're here when it matters most, with fuss-free pet insurance policies, including unlimited video call access with First Vet. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Text 84850.
Well, let's get the view, a different view from Israel, perhaps, with Noga Tonopolsky, a reporter based in Jerusalem. We had her on the show yesterday. We often turn to her on LBC for a measured sense of what's going on in Israel. Noga, thanks so much for joining us again this morning. I don't know how much of the conversation with the Israeli government spokesman you heard that I just had just now, but it sounded to me like they were saying, as far as they were concerned, ceasefire does not apply to Lebanon, and it will never apply to Lebanon. Such is the requirements of Israeli security. Is that the prevailing view in Israel?
Hi, Lewis. Good to see you. I wouldn't necessarily say it's the prevailing view, no. And I don't envy the position that Mr. Gandler's in, because he's a spokesperson for the embassy, and so he has to present that kind of a line. In Israel, there has been a very varied and not very positive assessment in general of what's happening. And the elephant in your conversation with Mr. Gandler, of course, is Mr. Netanyahu's political predicament. In other words, it may be the right decision for Israel, including in its position as an ally to the United States, to accept a two-week ceasefire also with Lebanon. It makes a lot of sense. But politically, Netanyahu cannot do it. Netanyahu promised safety for the north, and as long as Hezbollah is operating in the south, even if it's not bombing Israel, which today it is, it's bombing nonstop, but even if Hezbollah is not bombing Israel, if it's just gathering its forces, if it's building up its weapons stocks, if it's terrorizing residents of villages in the south, he has not fulfilled a promise that is a political kryptonite for him. And so Netanyahu can't, he doesn't have the wherewithal to tell Israelis, we're accepting this two-week ceasefire. We know this is upheaval in your life. We know many of you can't even live at home. Your kids haven't been in school. But this is an important wager for us. He can't do that. And so all he can tell Israelis is war and war and more war. Despite the fact, as you well said, Lewis, that almost three decades of war have brought Israel very little peace on the north.
In terms of, so what you're saying, Noga, is that, again, for people not familiar with the kind of intricacies of the Knesset, as a result of the coalition that Netanyahu has, that he must sustain to get to the Israeli election and potentially beyond it, even if, you're saying that even if Netanyahu were minded to go along with what Trump has said and the requirements of the ceasefire, just domestically, politically, he doesn't have the political space to do it. His coalition partners wouldn't permit him to do it.
That's right, although I would even put a bit more emphasis on Netanyahu's personal predicament. You know, he's been, for example, allowed to skip trial for the last 6 weeks of war because the Israeli judiciary, like the Israeli education system, and so much more has been on emergency footing. Sunday, he's supposed to go back to his own testimony in his corruption trial. That's not a good look ahead of his election. But mostly, he's boxed himself in. It is possible, in my mind, that even his most kind of messianic nationalist radical ministers might go along with a two-week pause if Netanyahu could explain it to them. But he can't, because he has promised, what has he promised Israelis? He's promised them that Hamas will be finished off and eradicated. Same for Hezbollah. He promised them regime change in Iran. He promised them a sort of bliss of safety and security in their small country in a difficult neighborhood. And he has delivered none of that. And concretely, he has not been able to deliver a third of this country, the entire north of the country, any sort of peace and quiet. The peace and quiet that did come, incidentally, came after a ceasefire very similar to the one being discussed now that Israel did sign on to in November of 2024. That brought a year of peace and quiet with Hezbollah. But at that time, Netanyahu was not able to say no to the incoming new president, Donald Trump, who was pushing for that. Now, again, I think I heard you say earlier that if Donald Trump decides that this is too much and picks up the phone and calls Netanyahu and says, cut it out for the next 10 days, I think Netanyahu won't have a choice, because he has so isolated Israel that Israel has, as an only diplomatic ally today, Donald Trump in the United States. But that call hasn't happened yet, and so Netanyahu is still telling his people, we're going to fight to the end.
And of course, Noga, we often talk about Israel and Israeli public opinion, and it is a very blunt instrument in terms of describing it, because of course politics in Israel is pluralist, and we can see that the war, and actually the outcome of the war, a little as we were talking about yesterday, is deeply contested politically in Israel, isn't it? I note that the opposition leader Yair Lapid, in a televised address, I think last night, said that Netanyahu has led us into a strategic debacle, selling lies to the Americans. I mean, this is strong stuff.
It's strong stuff. Yair Lapid made a very strong statement yesterday, as you said. He said that Netanyahu is also now lying to the Israeli people when he speaks about a victory in Iran, that this is a lie. He said, so Switzerland, he's not the only one. The chairman of the Israeli Labor Party, that's called the Democrats, said the same and said that, told Israelis this is not their inevitable fate to be isolated in the world and hearing lies from their leaders, that this can be changed. But, you know, I have to warn you, Netanyahu and his party, the Likud, have already been trying to find ways to postpone the elections. The situation is very stressful for them. And even though Israelis did begin this war with almost across-the-board support, the support was for the notion of fighting Iran. Of Israelis have been acutely aware, in part thanks to Netanyahu, but Israelis have been acutely aware of basically an existential threat from Iran trying to get access to nuclear weaponry and arming itself to the teeth with lethal ballistic missiles. So in that sense, Israelis supported an effort to eliminate that threat. But Netanyahu's support among Israelis didn't even go up one notch throughout this war. And I think that with this ambivalent, kind of ambiguous ending that was clearly imposed by Donald Trump, I don't think he's going to gain in popularity. I should add something. In Netanyahu's pre-taped statement yesterday that came a full 18 hours after the ceasefire was announced, one of the least persuasive points was when he said no. The Americans did not surprise us. He was trying to show how close he is to Trump and that he's always talking to Trump, whereas all of the reporting, including all of the reporting in Israel, indicates that Israel was surprised and was deeply unhappy about the news of this ceasefire.
Noga Tonopolsky there, reporter based in Jerusalem, joining us live from Jerusalem. We're going to continue this conversation about the ceasefire or not so ceasefire, the war or war of words around the ceasefire. That is just how contested or how deep in the political mire we appear to be. Groundhog Day, day zero, all over again. And in particular, I want to talk to you about this question of, never mind who do we believe, why has it broken down so quickly and will it be resurrected even by the end of the day? 0345 60 60 973. The time is 11 o'clock.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Keir Starmer has arrived in Abu Dhabi for talks with Gulf leaders as the Iran ceasefire deal looks at risk of collapsing. Iran has called Israel's attacks on Lebanon a breach, despite the US insisting it's excluded from the deal. Lebanese officials say more than 254 people were killed yesterday. Alex Gandler is a spokesperson for the Israeli embassy in London and has spoken to Lewis Goodall on LBC this morning.
If you are to believe anyone, you should believe the parties involved, the parties in question.
Then we believe no one because you both disagree.
We said from the get-go, right from the beginning, that Lebanon is not part of this ceasefire agreement that was signed between the United States and Iran. Israel's interest in Lebanon is to stop Hezbollah from firing at our civilians in the north of Israel.
French officials say four people have died after a small boat capsized in the English Channel. It happened earlier this morning. A search and rescue operation is ongoing. LBC has learned the Defence Secretary was spotted on a flight to the south of France last week, despite rising tensions in the Middle East. The sighting of John Healey came after Donald Trump issued his threat to bomb Iran back to the Stone Ages. The Ministry of Defence has declined to say whether it was an official ministerial business trip or a holiday. Speaking to Nick Ferrari at breakfast earlier today, the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper insisted that Mr Healey chaired operational briefings over the Easter break.
I think he was in continual contact, just as I was, just as other ministers were, whether they are in their departments, whether they are in their constituencies, whether they are overseas. You'll understand, for example, both as the Defence Secretary and the Foreign Secretary and also the Prime Minister have to do international trips as part of our job. And we maintain continual contact as we do so.
You can read more on this story on the LBC app. There's concerns that some vulnerable patients in England are being placed in inhumane conditions while waiting for mental health beds. the Health and Safety Watchdog, has issued the warning. It says a lack of powers for staff to prevent people from walking out of A&E leads to them finding the least harmful way to break the law. Ministers say an upcoming consultation will examine whether the law is clear enough. And the crew on NASA's Artemis 2 mission are preparing to splash down back on Earth tomorrow. They've journeyed further into space than any humans in history after travelling around the far side of the moon. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 33 at 10,575. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather, spells of rain will push eastwards but staying dry in the south. Elsewhere, rain will clear to leave sunny spells, a high of 23 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Sorry for the voice note, but can we get a takeaway tonight, Mum?
Oh, no, no. We've got leftovers in the fridge. They'll do. It'd be nice.
Sorry. I've eaten it. Who's for pizza?
Pizza!
Sure, we can give you lots of data, but what really matters is friends and family. That's why we're happy to be your second most important network. Tesco Mobile. It pays to be connected. Terms apply. See tescomobile.com/ytescomobile.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11:04. You're listening to Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien all this week on LBC. I can see in the corner, out the corner of my eye, that the Defence Secretary, John Healey, is not in the south of France. He's in Downing Street, and he is giving a briefing. I think, in fact, about Russian aggression, particularly on underwater, undersea cables. Our political editor, Natasha Clark, is there. We'll be checking in with her about what the Defence Secretary has been saying a little bit later on. Just since Noga mentioned it there at the end, Noga Tomopolsky from Jerusalem, that statement from Yair Lapid, the leader of the opposition, obviously he's a political opponent of Netanyahu, so you'd expect him not to mince his words, but extraordinary statement, really, that he made in the most blunt language. Netanyahu, he said, led us into a strategic debacle in Iran. Nothing less. This is Israeli opposition leader. What we saw was a disgraceful combination of arrogance, irresponsibility, lack of planning, negligent staff work, zero handling of the home front, lies sold to the Americans that damaged the trust between our two countries. A military success turned into a diplomatic disaster. That is from the Israeli opposition leader. I want to talk to you this hour, not so much about which side you believe, but more about why you think the ceasefire, 24 hours on, is already in tatters. Who is to blame? 0345 6060973. And will it be back up and running again by the end of the day when Donald Trump has woken up and given Benjamin Netanyahu a ring? Well, let's get the view of Lord Peter Ricketts, former UK National Security Advisor, of course, under the Cameron, in the Cameron government. Lord Ricketts, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Were you surprised that the ceasefire appeared to have run aground so quickly?
Honestly, I wasn't surprised that it was very messy, Lewis, because of the way it was negotiated. I mean, chaotic circumstances, messages being passed through the night between some Americans and somebody on the Iranian side via the Pakistanis, no agreed written text as far as I know, and therefore lots and lots of ambiguity about what was agreed. And in particular, it seems that this issue of Lebanon wasn't properly nailed down. I suspect nobody told Netanyahu that this ceasefire was coming, and he wasn't on board. So, I mean, let's see. But I suspect that this massive Israeli strike yesterday, killing several hundred people in Beirut, may have been because Netanyahu recognized he is going to get that phone call from Trump saying, knock off the war in Lebanon to hold the ceasefire.
So the Pakistani Prime Minister's office have indicated, not been explicit about it, but they've indicated that their assumption or working assumption, which was this was a sort of more regional ceasefire. But are you saying that it's entirely possible that to answer that question that I started with as to sort of who is responsible, that it's possible that kind of almost no one was responsible apart from the fact that it was sort of so shoddily and drafted at the last minute and that the process was so poor and ramshackle that everybody might have actually believed what they believed and no one was actually particularly sure of the particulars?
I think that's quite likely, Lewis, yes. I mean, perhaps not for me to say, but, you know, no diplomats were involved as far as I can see. It was presidential aides and unknown people on the Iranian side. And I suspect in the court of Donald Trump, you don't always say to the boss, you know, the full reality. You tell him that there's a great ceasefire on offer, perhaps don't give him the fine print. Maybe he was unaware about the Lebanon issue. I don't know. But anyway, it was clearly not properly nailed down. And that has led to this huge violation, as the Iranians see it, and I think the Pakistanis, which has now got to be put right. And until that's put right, I think passage through the Strait of Hormuz is going to be, you know, absolutely held to ransom by the Iranians.
And whatever the Americans said yesterday about the Americans begging for a ceasefire, it's clear that they were at least as desirous of the ceasefire as the Iranians were, if not more at this point. Given that, might we expect that when Donald Trump gets up, which will probably be in about an hour's time, and we know because he starts truthing immediately, that he will be on the phone to Jerusalem, to Benjamin Netanyahu, and saying, this is what I want, it needs to happen?
I think so. Yes, I think so, because he's staked a lot on this ceasefire. As you say, I think he was pretty desperate for it. I think the Iranians sensed that and ensured that in the exchanges they had, they got some kind of agreement from Trump to their, you know, to use their 10-point plan as a workable arrangement, or something he said. I mean, that goes a long way in the direction of the Iranian interest and probably will never actually get to a final settlement. But Trump has a lot riding on making this ceasefire work, yes. And therefore, I suspect he's going to have to try and bring the Israelis in line, which is why they've been getting their big blow in first.
And of course, it takes two to tango in anything. And so assuming that the Americans do that to the Israelis, do the Iranians have sufficient hold over Hezbollah to make them do the same?
Yes, I think so. I think they can. And I suspect that they will. If there is a, you know, the Israelis stop firing on Hezbollah, I think they will put the arm wrestle on the Hezbollah, who are pretty dependent on them. You know, they're in pretty desperate straits in Lebanon. They've been very badly hit while the world has been watching Iran. So, yeah, I think it could go back to a very fragile ceasefire with perhaps a little bit of further passage of vessels through the straits. But you know, even when you think about what is reopening the Strait of Hormuz, it's an easy thing to say. What does it mean? I think it means something completely different to the Americans than it does to the Iranians, who intend to go on charging a toll for it. So even that, when you get to more detailed negotiations, pinning that down into an arrangement that will last is going to be extremely difficult.
And of course, this is just about the ceasefire, not about a permanent resolution to the Iran crisis, which in one form or another has burned along for, well over 10 years. What chance do you think there is, assuming that Trump makes that call and the Iranians make that call to Hezbollah, and then we do go back to where we thought we would be this time yesterday, which is a sort of very fragile ceasefire? What chances do you think there are of anything coming of it and actually stopping a return to fighting in just 2 weeks' time?
Well, I think the chances are pretty low, Lewis, to be absolutely honest. Think of the Gaza ceasefire a year ago or so. I mean, that was also first stage ceasefire, second stage permanent peace settlement in Gaza. There's been absolutely no progress at all, as far as I can see, towards pinning down a real peace settlement in Gaza. And it's going to be even more difficult in the case of Iran. I mean, what we might see, I guess, is a separate channel of negotiation on the nuclear program. Because there, you remember, the day before they were attacked, the Iranians and Americans were negotiating on the nuclear front. I think the Iranians are prepared to accept they won't have a nuclear weapon. They will insist on having some kind of right to continue, you know, nuclear technology and cooperation, and they might be prepared to do something about those 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium if they can be found. So it's possible to see a sort of separate deal on the nuclear side and then a ceasefire in the strait, which perhaps then lingers and becomes something like the new normal. But a wider regional peace settlement, I think, is very low likelihood.
Is it fair to say that the Iranians, during any negotiations to come, are now in a more potent and more powerful position than they were in the negotiations which were taking place before the war started 41 days ago?
I'm sorry to say, I think that's true, yes. I mean, because they have shown how powerful leverage is the control of the Strait of Hormuz, and also how vulnerable the Gulf countries are to attacks on their massive oil and gas infrastructure, you know, thousands of acres of very expensive technology. Yes, I think the world realizing that and Iran being reinforced in the knowledge that they have that chokehold on the world economy, they're not going to give that up. They're going to want to monetize that to start paying the massive bill for reconstruction in their country.
Has the war achieved anything?
Made things worse, I think. I mean, honestly, there was a negotiation going on with Iran before this started. It could have reached deal. There was a deal 10 years ago on the Iranian nuclear program. We need not have been here. And I think things are now more fragile, more dangerous than they were before.
And what do you think it means and ought to mean now, thinking about British foreign policy for not just the next few weeks and months, but for the remainder of this decade? I mean, the United States under Trump, I mean, this is a, it strikes me that, this period of Trump, the Trump restoration, it feels very different even from the first term. You know, the first term often appeared disorderly, but there was more reason and logic than perhaps met the eye. It feels to me that there's less logic and reason than often meets the eye this time. What does it mean, or what do you think it does require us now to make some fundamental revisions to our assumptions about our place in the world and the transatlantic relationship?
Well, I think it does. I mean, you know, my father's generation fought and died because they wanted to avoid a world where strong men could barge into other people's countries, occupy them, smash them to pieces with impunity. And that international order that they established after 1945, it did work up to a point. It is now completely shredded. And I think the idea that America is an ally in any real sense of the word, we've got to forget that. It's a transactional country. We will have interests there, but you know, they're not going to be an ally in the way they have been. We have got to rethink NATO, and therefore we've got to get closer to the Europeans on defense and security. I think the assumptions that I had throughout my diplomatic career, you know, are now basically gone, and we have to rethink who our real friends and allies are in the world and how we get closer.
You would put it as explicitly and as boldly as that, Lord Ricketts, that we cannot think of America as an ally anymore, not just Trump, but the United States itself.
Well, it's not an ally in the kind of way it's been for the last 80 years, in my view. I mean, it will work with us where it's in our interests, and where it won't, it will ignore us or go against them. So I think that is a fact. We're in that world. We've got to make the best of it as far as we can. I don't think America is going to go back to a sort of Joe Biden period of, you know, very positive about the transatlantic relationship after Trump. America has moved on from that. Their interests are now much more towards the China and the confrontation there. And so even if a future president is not as brutal and raw as Trump is, I think we can't expect them to go back to bankrolling European security. It's a different world.
And therefore, just finally, what does that mean? You've already alluded to it or referred to it. What does that mean for NATO? I mean, right as we're speaking right now, John Healey, Defence Secretary, is talking about an attempt by President Putin, by the Russian government, as the British government is saying, to damage and attack and sabotage underwater cables, pipelines. We've seen them try to do that before. He's saying they've tried to do that again, I think, about a month or so. Is NATO, with Trump is briefing and saying that Trump is considering punishing unhelpful NATO. We saw Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, meeting with Trump yesterday. He said those conversations were very frank, which I think is diplomatic speak for pretty apocalyptic. Is NATO in any sense now a going concern? I mean, if Putin were to invade Tallinn or Helsinki tomorrow, do we really believe that Trump would be there?
Well, that's the point. I mean, NATO is a treaty, but it's also about trust, and it's mostly about trust. The treaty will still be there. NATO's got 10,000 people, civil servants, military people working in all kinds of headquarters and planning staffs. That will go on. But if the essential trust is not there, if you can't be sure that America would be there, as you say, if Putin went into Estonia or somewhere, you know, then NATO as a functioning vital organization, you know, is deeply damaged. And I think that's where we are, which is why all the Europeans, including the British, are now talking actively about much closer working together with countries like Canada, Australia, other middle-sized powers, because the fundamental trust that bound us together in NATO for 80 years is no longer there.
Mark Rutte said yesterday after his meeting with Trump that the world is safer now than it was before the Iran war because Trump had degraded Iran's capabilities. Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't. Rutte has his particular role as a kind of Trump whisperer, and I think he sees it as his mission to try and keep as good relations with Trump as possible. Okay, but honestly, I think he exaggerates there, and I don't agree with him.
That is Lord Ricketts, former National Security Advisor under David Cameron. Grateful for your time, Lord Ricketts. Want to continue this conversation about why you think the ceasefire is already in tatters. Do you agree with what Lord Ricketts is saying there, that frankly the process was so ramshackle, so half-cocked, so last minute, that it is entirely possible that all of the parties actually believe what they believed, that Iran believed that Israel was covered, that Lebanon was covered, and the Israelis believed that Lebanon wasn't covered, and the US believed that Lebanon wasn't covered, and no one bothered to check. I don't know what's worse. Honestly, I don't know what's worse. I don't know what's worse. Is it that basically this utterly vital historic agreement, as Trump said, was put together in so cack-handed a manner that no one was really sure what the particulars were? Or is it worse that someone is lying and they knew and they're reneging on it? And of course, we can't quite know. And that's what I want your view on. Why has the ceasefire already collapsed? And which would be worse? Someone lying or no one really understanding it in the first place? 0345 60 60973. 0345 60 60973. You can WhatsApp on that number, of course. Text 84850. We'll keep an eye on that live press conference with the Defence Secretary, John Healey, about what he is calling growing Russian aggression, particularly with regards to undersea, underwater cables and so on. The time is 11:18.
LBC.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it, and the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Need anything from Tesco? Like Ben and Jerry's ice cream, now £3 each, down from £5.55.
Club card accepted.
Because every little helps. Majority of larger stores selected 465ml tubs ends 13th of April. Club card or app required.
How would you like to pay?
Whatever, just take this card.
Or pay with the PayPal debit card. No harps! You can get 10 times the points on your PayPal purchases with their new rewards program, PayPal Plus.
Wow, that's a lot of points. But who are you?
I'm the smarter voice inside your head. I'm filling in for your regular smarter voice. She's got laryngitis. Hear the harps. Sign up for PayPal Plus for free in the app. Pay smarter. PayPal.
Enrollment required. Earn 1 point per £10 at PayPal online checkout. 10 per £10 with PayPal debit card. Eligible purchases only. PayPal debit card can be used where MasterCard is accepted. Terms apply.
From the big transformations to the small home improvements, you can feel as proud as a peacock with Wix.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 60 60 973.
Time is 11:20. I mean, basically, if we're really just getting to the heart of this and distilling it, it's basically the oldest sort of bit of analysis of politics, isn't it? Or trying to understand what's really happening in politics. Is it cock-up or is it conspiracy? Now, more often than not, particularly in British politics, it's cock-up, quite frankly, because our lords and masters politically aren't really capable of conspiracy. And I'm sort of inclined to often believe that that is the explanation in international affairs as well. But, of course, this is of such import and such vital importance in terms of what happens next now with this agreement, that we've got to consider all possibilities. Again, the Pakistanis have indicated that their belief was that this would also covered Lebanon, this ceasefire. But it doesn't, of course, mean that everybody understood it to mean that when it was signed, insofar as it was signed at all. As Lord Ricketts was saying there, no professional diplomats were involved. As ever, Steve Witkoff, the kind of like international Trumpian handyman of peace, sort of going around the world. Not an amazing track record, it has to be said, involved in this as well. J.D. Vance. And the Americans, what is clear, the Americans were desperate for a deal in almost any circumstances. After Trump had given that genocidal ultimatum, he needed a little life raft at any cost. The Pakistanis presented him with one, and I completely believe that he signed up to it without really bothering to read the T's and C's or even check what they were. Basil is in Stockport. Basil, good morning.
Good morning, Lewis. You had some great callers there, especially Lord Ricketts.
Yes,
and
he's a class act, isn't
caller.
He? Yeah. If only he were in charge of negotiating this thing, we probably wouldn't be in this situation.
Well, yeah, you were mentioning cock-up or conspiracy. I think it's a combination of the two. My wife is Lebanese, and I have family in Lebanon and Beirut as we speak. My sister's just gone into the mountains, and I am no fan of Hezbollah. I am no fan of
They're a murderous group. Yeah.
They are, an Iranian regime. But I'm also no fan of the Zionist state that is pretending to be a democracy in the Middle East while acting like a rogue state. And it's really important that the bombs yesterday, there was no evacuation warning, there was no military targets, there was just indiscriminate bombing of civilian population, killing nearly 300 people.
Well, I should just say, Basil, just for this, you just say what the Israelis would say. I mean, first of all, they would say that they are a democracy, and they are, of course, internally a democracy. Of course, you can argue that they're not acting like a democracy, but you could argue maybe America's not acting like a democracy either. Yeah. And they say that they do provide warnings to civilians. This is, of course, disputed sometimes, but they certainly have been known to do so.
Well, certainly they have been known to do so. They've done it in the southern Lebanon. They did it in areas of Gaza, but they didn't do it yesterday. Only because Benjamin Netanyahu is a chancer. He's a political chancer. He's fighting for his life. He realises that a war prime minister is the best way to get re-elected. He's got charges against his all sorts of political foes, and he will come down. Now, the war will keep him in power. That's the reason why this will continue. Trump will get on the phone to him today and say, naughty boy, you should stop, because Beirut was part of the deal. Everybody knows it was part of the deal. And why wouldn't it be part of the deal? There's no benefit whatsoever of Israel continuing to attack Beirut, because they are not going to defeat Hezbollah, like they are not going to defeat Hamas, without a political solution. We're just going round and round in circles, wasting lives and people's time.
Well, of course, I think there's definitely something in what you're saying, Basil. I mean, something I think that we maybe in Britain don't understand, because obviously most people don't follow the ins and outs of Israeli politics, is that, you know, one of the drivers of this instability, undoubtedly, and I preface this by saying, of course, Israel does have absolutely legitimate and valid security concerns. We saw the horror of what happened a couple of years ago, October 7th. We saw, you know, this ongoing conflict with Hezbollah has been going on and off for 20 years. Completely legitimate. And I completely understand if you're an ordinary Israeli civilian living under the threat of Hezbollah rockets or whatever it happens to be, then you completely understand those security concerns. But it's also true to say as well that Israeli politics, one of the drivers of this instability, is the hardening and polarization of Israeli politics. The great old party that founded the Israeli democracy, like the Israeli Labour Party, now much, much weaker. And then you've got someone like the Likud Party, which actually, even when it was being run by Ariel Sharon, who at that time we thought of as a hardliner, an absolute minnow by comparison to the attitudes that someone like Netanyahu has dominated Israeli politics for all these years. And he himself is more mellow by comparison to the absolute far-right radicalised forces who are in his cabinet and his government, that even if Netanyahu wanted to cut a deal with these people, most of the time, these maniacs and these radicals, because that's what they are, would not allow him to do so.
Well, you make a good point, but let's compare Ariel Sharon, Sabra and Shatila, with killing maybe over 20,000 Palestinians and Christians, murdering Lebanese on the street, and then Benjamin Netanyahu killing 70,000 and 30,000 of them being children. The mask has been unveiled. People like you and other proper central media now are exposing the lies and the corruption and the inhumane Zionist theories that they are trying to peddle. Nobody's buying it anymore. People understand what's happening in the Middle East. People understand there's two sides to the story. Obviously, Israel's got a right to exist. Of course it is. And obviously, we want to get rid of all the terrorist organisations across the Middle East. But by proxy fighting, by bombing, by just mowing the lawn as they've done in Gaza, that is not the way to do it.
Well,
Hamas is still there. Hezbollah is going to be there, and they'll be there in another 100 years, because it's an ideology as much as a political or military force. So you have to do politics, similar to what we did with the IRA,
yep,
similar to what we've done in other areas. We've got to be diplomatic, run, yep, things properly. And the ceasefire, by the way, will come back into force tomorrow, but it is a sham. And Israel will break it, by the way. Israel will break it in the next two, three weeks.
Basil in Stockport there. I mean, what he says there, and again, I just sort of preface this by saying, you know, I want Israel to be a flourishing success story, just as I want Gaza to be a flourishing success story. Just these are not, it's not a zero-sum game. There should be a right, and ought to be a right, for all of those states in the Middle East to live in peace and in prosperity. And all of those places have a right to exist and coexist peacefully with one another. And Israel absolutely has legitimate security concerns that need to be addressed. But I go back to what I was saying to Mr. Gantner earlier in the show. They've played this game for a long time now. And the truth is that peace is never going to be born from the barrel of a gun, because you can't kill an idea. We learned that. I think Basil's absolutely right to bring it up. We learned that the hard way over a century or so in Ireland, Northern Ireland, partition, the troubles, the rest of it. In the end, stability and peace, and it's still got a long way to go in itself, only came when both sides were exhausted and realised and accepted that in the end, neither would be secure down the barrel of a gun. And this is just something that, to be fair, Hezbollah as well does not accept or does not seem to understand. And as a result, we just go on this endless cycle of death and destruction. Malcolm is in Tel Aviv. Malcolm, good morning. Good afternoon, where you are.
Hi, hey. Good afternoon. Yes, I can't remember. First of all, have you been here?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. I'm going to move slightly away to the first part of your topic this morning and then come back.
Yeah.
When you had that gentleman say about, Israel is targeting the Christians and Muslims in Lebanon.
Yeah.
What he fails to understand, even 10 minutes ago, Hezbollah was sending rockets over towards Haifa and Akko, which is predominantly, well, it's virtually 50-50 Muslim, Jewish, Christian, no, that's mainly a third, Christian. All the denominations are here as well, getting targeted by Hezbollah and Iran. So I just want to put that bit clear.
Yep. We should be absolutely clear. Hezbollah are a murderous force who've been responsible for the deaths of many people, Israelis and non-Israelis alike.
Yeah, I mean, I've been covering this. I'm a cameraman here. So I was covering last week when that elderly couple, their carer and son, got killed by a Hezbollah missile. Across the road from me, three cars got flattened. In fact, I think I sent Nick all the video and pictures of my report. But going back to what you're saying now, people are tired. The Israelis, they're exhausted by all of this.
They must be.
And there's no trust. There's no trust with Trump, with Netanyahu, with the Iranian regime. No one can believe what anyone's saying. Now, what people would like to see is a copy, in Farsi translated into English, of what the Iranians believe to be a ceasefire, and to what the Americans' copy shows up. No one really understands who to believe anymore.
What do you think, in terms of the people you're speaking to in Tel Aviv, Malcolm, What do you think that they want at this point? You say they're exhausted. I'm not surprised they're exhausted. It must be completely exhausting living under that constant threat for everyone in the region. What do they want now? What would their ideal outcome be at this point?
Yeah, an ideal world would be no Hamas, no Hezbollah, no IRGC. To go back to the ones who remember when it was Persia and the great relationship they had with Israel and both ways. I'm saying your producer, there's still a railway track on the northern part of Israel and Lebanon that was supposed to be a railway coming from Europe all the way down to Egypt. And obviously many years ago, and you can still see the tracks. The people want peace. And I think the Israelis here, they've got no gripe with your everyday Lebanese person. What they do feel is they're being manipulated in a way by A, the government here, and B, by the Lebanese government saying one thing but actually not fulfilling what they were going to do regarding Hezbollah. They would love to see the old Iran or Persia, if they want to call it that again.
Not going to happen, though, is it?
They don't know where. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
Netanyahu has tried that theory. It's clear. I mean, to me, it's very clear. Netanyahu had convinced Trump that if the bombs started falling, that the Iranians would rise up and the regime would fall. Now, who knows? Maybe the regime will still fall at some point. Maybe they have been destabilized in the medium to long term. Who knows? Doesn't feel like that right now, but who knows? It certainly hasn't happened yet. And so short of regime change, in the end, you're not going to be able to destroy them from the air. So you're back in square one, aren't you? You need a deal that they're now less likely to sign up to. And now they actually feel more powerful because they've got the Strait of Hormuz and the chokehold that they've managed to show the whole world they have.
Which I think certainly Europe and the States knew they had this in the first place. They knew if anything like this would happen, this would be their ace in their pack. And it has proved that now.
Yes.
Also, I think, obviously, before we have to go, is the thing is that, again, people don't have faith in any of the governments. They don't. They see things on news. You see certain things on news. I try and pull out what I see in my by filming these reports. But no one really understands what's really going on.
Malcolm, in Tel Aviv, grateful to you giving us the point of view from the, that vantage point, that bit of the world. And look, I think it's absolutely no surprise at all that Israelis are exhausted, as people will be across the entire region, of this endless war. And that is precisely my point. As someone who wants to see Israel succeed, just like all of the peoples of the Middle East succeed and countries in the Middle East succeed, as long as they can live in harmony and coexistence. What the Israeli government is doing and what Netanyahu is doing is testing to destruction the idea that that security can be born down the barrel of a gun. It never has been and it never will. News headlines at 11:33 with Dominic Ellis.
The Defence Secretary has revealed the UK has detected increased Russian activity in the Atlantic. John Healey says three submarines carried out a covert operation over a month tracking critical cables in waters north of the UK. Mr. Healey's also condemned Israel's attacks on Lebanon as concerns grow that the Iran ceasefire could collapse. Iran has called Israel's airstrikes on Lebanon a breach, but the US insists it is excluded from the deal. And officials in France say two men and two women have died after trying to cross the channel in a small boat. It's understood at least 42 people were trying to board the vessel when it got into difficulties this morning. LBC weather, spells of rain pushing eastwards but staying dry in the south. Rain will clear elsewhere to leave some sunny spells, a high of 23 degrees.
This is LBC.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less less. Irish Ferries, see you travel differently. T's and C's apply.
Ready for a new kitchen? Wix Kitchen Experts can support you with clever designs and a professional installation. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
At Lidl, there's always more to value. Like switching from Morrisons to Lidl and saving £40 on this week's Big Shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Which means a stocked up fridge of big brands, award-winning own brands, and your fresh value of a day with extra helpings encouraged. Lidl, more to value. Prices check 7th of the 4th, 26. Morrisons also sell other products. See online for more details.
Do you ever feel like getting back under your duvet in the middle of the day? Ferroglobin is a great tasting liquid formula with iron, which contributes to the reduction of tiredness and fatigue and normal formation of haemoglobin. Ferroglobin from Vitabiotics at Boots, pharmacies and vitabiotics.com.
It's happened again. All you said was barrel leg. Now she's looking at you like Nadine isn't your real name. Look at you go, as you explain volume cocoon is a key shape for the season. 100% cotton, you say? No way, she says. And then, oh, a little extension of the trouser leg. Check out that pleat. Then you break the news. They're from Primark, only £16. Be a good friend. You can borrow them. Hopefully she'll forget that. Shockingly chic for £16. That's so Primark. Available in-store and on click and collect.
People ask me, what's my good place? Checking out the food trucks on the weekend with my partner. And knowing that Pension B helped me combine my pensions into one easy-to-manage plan.
Tacos?
Tacos.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Time is 11:36. Well, yesterday, international markets reacted with joy insofar as international capital markets and trading markets and commodities markets can have joy. They responded with joy that the Straits of Hormuz would be opened again, and the price of a barrel of oil declined significantly. And it looked like that there may be, although inevitably there'll be damage which lasts months, economic damage because of the damage which has taken place against existing energy infrastructure, that we might look to a period of some more normality in terms of international shipping and getting all of that oil, in particular fertilizer and so on, flowing to European and Western markets. Of course, that opening lasted not even a day, and even then was on worse terms than we had before the start of the war, because, of course, the Iranians were pledging to say that they would exact a toll on all ships that went through, something that was not the case in the status quo ante. Now, as we've been saying, John Healey, the Defence Secretary, is currently giving a live press conference, I think, from Downing Street, actually about Russian aggression, particularly with regards to underwater cables and so on, an ongoing sore of relations between Russia and Europe. Healey has been asked his reaction to the possibility, because Trump has said that maybe he would like to get in his endless constant grift, would like to get in on the idea of charging a toll on the Straits of Hormuz with Iran, a sort of joint US-Iran toll booth, peace in our time. This is what John Healey had to say.
We want to see the ceasefire reinforced and strengthened. We want to see it extended to Israel and Lebanon. And we want to see a Strait of Hormuz that remains open, free, consistent with the long-established laws of international navigation without any sort of tolls for passage.
We'll get more on that, on more on what John Healey's been saying with Natasha Clark, our political editor, shortly. She's in Downing Street. As I say, bulk of that has been about Russian activity. But just consider that. Consider what Trump said yesterday. He was asked by ABC about whether the Iranians, whether it was okay with Trump that the Iranians would charge a toll for all ships that go through the Strait of Hormuz. And remember, of course, that Trump said at the start of the war, or pretty quickly after the war began, that you had to have completely unimpeded access to the Strait. Trump has completely changed his tune. Only the day before, he was threatening to completely wipe out the Iranian civilization. Yesterday, he says this. He says, we're thinking of doing it as a joint venture. It's a way of securing it, also securing it from lots of other people. It's a beautiful thing. A beautiful thing. A toll between the US and Iran on the Strait of Hormuz. Basically raising money. But just consider that. Consider that. We've gone from a situation where the American president was threatening to wipe out Iranian civilization to actually saying, you know what, lads, let's operate a toll booth together. That's where we've gone in 24 hours, and we wonder why that we're in the mess that we're in. And Trump doubtless hasn't even thought about it for a single second. But think about this. If that actually happens, and we have a situation that we didn't have before the war, where the Iranians charge a toll on every ship going through the Strait of Hormuz, then every time you fill up your car, or pretty much every time you buy anything, because directly or indirectly, the chances are it's going to have been affected by energy and so on that has come through the Strait, and oil that's come through the Strait, fertilizer and so on. Basically, we're all going to be sending money directly to the IRGC, a group of people that the Israelis and the Americans have been telling us for the past few weeks who basically have got a bomb to bits and hope fall. But now we're actually going to be supporting them financially with this new Trump plan. It beggars belief. And we wonder, as I say, why we're in the mess that we're in. Oh, and by the way, they might even be paid in Bitcoin. Oh, I wonder which bit of Bitcoin, I wonder which bit of crypto the President of the United States might favour with regards to that. It wouldn't be Trump coin by any chance, would it? It really is that more than anything else, we keep implying or applying strategic logic onto the Trump White House. The best way of understanding it, 9 times out of 10, is that more often than not, it is a grift. Remember the Apprentice theme tune when back when he was doing something that was more useful in humiliating Americans on his American evening show? What was the theme tune? Money, 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 money. That's all you need to know. Let's talk to Dickie, who's in Marlow. Dickie.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, Dickie. Very, very well. Well as we can be. I mean, we've not had nuclear war in the past 36 hours. So I suppose we've got to bank that as a win.
I don't know if that's more luck than judgment.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of points I want to make, and if you bear with me, because it's about, I think we need to change the conversation about the whole Middle Eastern question, about Israel, because one of your callers earlier said that I totally accept Israel's right to exist, okay? And if we took countries don't have a right to exist. And I'll give you some examples. Yugoslavia was a country. Did that have a right to exist? It existed for 74 years. It's now 7 individual countries. What has a right to exist is people. People make up countries. Now, Israel's position, let's be fair, they're the only country. Well, this is not an anti-Israel thing. I have no skin in the game as far as any other country outside of my own. But if we look at the UK as an example, does that mean that Scottish independence doesn't have a right to exist because the UK exists and therefore Scotland's part of that, so they don't have that right? So that, let's get that argument out of the way.
Well, I suppose, let me just say that, I mean, I know what you mean. Like, it is a bit of a sleight of hand, and it's obviously something that we apply and talk about with Israel specifically. But I suppose, just to push back, I suppose the reason that it's talked about, and you're right, no, no state has an intrinsic right to exist, and countries come and countries go. I suppose the reason that we talk about it with this and we ask people whether or not they believe that Israel has a right to exist is because it's a sort of shorthand to see whether or not they believe that Israel ought not basically to be destroyed. Because Israel is an unusual state in a sense that obviously the day it was founded in 1948, basically all of its neighbours decided to try and destroy it. And they could argue, and they certainly feel, that many of these neighbours, or at least some of them, have been trying to destroy them ever since. So it is an unusual state, which is, I think, why we sometimes talk about that rather unusual kind of unusual question.
I understand the nuance. I do understand the nuance of when we talk about, does a Jewish state have a right to exist? Of course it does. Of course it does.
Yes.
But by its very nature, a state must define its borders. And at the moment, Israel is the only state in the world that doesn't define its own border. So the problem being is the reason the war is continuing, because Israel, let's be fair, the power structure of Israel at the moment is an extreme right-wing viewpoint who do believe in Israeli expansionism, and that's rubbing against the shoulders of its nearest borders, because it's pushing into the Lebanon. The situation in Gaza is ghastly. I think there's only one word to describe it, and anyone that says it's not a genocide, I think, is being untruthful in their own mind, because you cannot do what the Western powers have actively supported Israel doing and not question the validity of the statement that there is a genocide going on. Enough scholars have said
that. But
whether you agree with it or don't agree with it is immaterial.
But Dickie, if I can draw you back to the question, why do you think the ceasefire, I understand all of that, but why do you think the ceasefire is already in tatters?
Oh, it's really simple. Let's be honest. Netanyahu knows that as a wartime leader, with a country at war, he is liable to stay in power, because there is a very big backing, because it's been nationalised that he is the leader in a wartime country. The moment the war ends, let's be honest, they're going to have an election because they've been delayed. Netanyahu, in all the polls, in a peacetime area, loses. If he loses power, he goes to prison. There's no other way. The charges are there. They're just waiting for him not to be. They can't press charges. Why? But the evidence is absolutely mounting.
But he must know. He must know at some point, Dickie. It's got to end at some point.
Has it?
Well, I suppose it depends which bit of the conflict, I suppose. The Iran bit will certainly end. But the Lebanon bit has been going on for 20 years.
Yeah, and I tend to favour the people that put this deal together is the Pakistani government have done a fantastic job of getting people round a table. They are saying, of course it included Lebanon. Who do we believe in this? In this situation, I am absolutely convinced the Pakistani have no skin in the game other than to bring about a peaceful solution. So innocent people who have that intangible right to exist can exist without the threat of being blown up by bombs from either side.
Well, Dickie, what do you think? Just briefly, Lord Ricketts offered, the former National Security Advisor at the top of the hour, offered a slightly different view, which was his belief is that on the balance of probabilities, that he thinks that actually the chances are it's entirely possible that all three sides sort of actually believe what they believe, because the deal was put together in such a rush because Trump was so desperate for it that actually no one really understood the particulars.
That's a viewpoint. I hold a different viewpoint. I think that is stretching the bounds of credulity a little bit for me. I don't think these key players would make a difference between they're negotiating the end of hostilities. That is the point of this ceasefire. A ceasefire is, we're going to have a little ceasefire in this bit of the region, but we're going to carry on bombing this bit. That's not a ceasefire. A ceasefire, by its very terminology, is we are going to cease
firing. Well, the Israelis would say, but the Israelis would say that this is a separate theatre to Iran and the Iran conflict.
Well, it's their nearest neighbour. Let's be honest, they're being disingenuous. Hezbollah, which is a power force that are present in Lebanon and have been for many years, and the rights and the wrongs of that are a separate debate, they are Iranian-backed. Now, as far as when I read it, it's the whole agreement was Iran and its allies. of who? Hezbollah. Well, let's not debate the rights and wrongs of these organisations, which we all know largely are murderous, butcherous regimes. Hezbollah, the Houthi, whatever you want to do, there's fault on both sides. But it's fairly evident, I think, that Israel saying, oh, we didn't get that bit, is disingenuous.
All right, Dickie.
A ceasefire in the region by its nature is a ceasefire. End of story.
All right, Dickie in Marlow, grateful to you. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Natasha Clark, LBC's political editor, of course, who has been at that press conference in Downing Street with John Healey, where the UK, he's announced, has exposed a covert Russian submarine operation. Vladimir Putin, the defence secretary, says, we see you. We'll be getting the latest on that. Time 11:47.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
This is a shameful, this is a shambles.
Straight to the point.
How was that allowed to happen?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Show some evidence, Minister.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do is...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's
my weight loss.
Weight loss?
Forget that. You just
have to keep dancing.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress. MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
How about Specsave ears?
Not sure.
Do you get it? Specsave ears?
Yeah, but no.
Oh, okay. Specs, and we also do hearing two savers.
Think about it. Should have gone to Specs and we also do hearing two savers. Can't see it catching on.
Okay, so we're saying Specsavers do eyes and ears. Senses savers.
Technically true.
Yeah.
But actually terrible.
Oh.
At Specsavers, we're hearing experts too, and have been for over 20 years.
Oh, should we just stick to Specsavers then?
Yeah.
Book a free hearing check today.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips?
Your best bet is to head over to Bet Victor. They've got bags of offers and promotions kicking about.
Like what?
For a start, all them weekly promotions.
Oh, yeah?
There's the Loyalty Club, the Bet Victor Predictor, and in Casino, they've got the Spinners Club, which is a weekly slot thingamajig. And you can also order food to your door.
Can you?
Oh, no, hang about. That's a different app.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet at Bet Victor. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. GambleAware.org.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK, so we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
At Lidl, there's always more to value. Like switching from Morrison's to Lidl and saving £40 on this week's big shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Which means a stocked up fridge of big brands, award-winning own brands and your fresh value a day with extra helpings encouraged. Lidl, more to value. Prices check 7th of the 4th, 26. Morrison's also sell other products. See online for more details.
Ready for a new kitchen? Wix Kitchen Experts can support you with clever designs and a professional installation. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time 11:50. A few of your texts and WhatsApps on this question of why the ceasefire has collapsed so quickly. Anthony says it's almost always cock up, never conspiracy. Look at the collapse of the Johnson government. Is he playing some clever game or chasing headlines? Are you Boris Johnson? We surely can't blame him for this, can we? Probably can. Trump's lot are similar. They don't believe in experts, experience, details. They're what most people call idiots. Is that a professional diagnosis? Ken says, if Iran was really smart, they should have said to Trump, why don't we charge for the use of the strait and split the income? I think, Ken, if Trump's tweet is anything to go by or his statements, well, ABC News. I think that's precisely what he'd like. And Brendan says, Lewis, in the inimitable roads of Logan Roy, oh, always good to quote Logan. You're not something serious people. The people who appointed, Trump appointed to carry out these negotiations. Oh, I stole your thunder there, Brendan. Are not serious people. When you need an important job carried out, you don't just send your friends and family. And Jack says, dear Lewis Goodall, it's very formal of you, Jack. Britain can lead us to world peace the sooner we abandon Israel, says Jack from Dagenham. I think you're rather overestimating our own abilities right now, Jack. On another matter, we've been reporting that the Defence Secretary, John Healey, has been giving a live press conference in Downing Street where he said that three Russian subs carried out a covert operation in the Atlantic north of the UK lasting longer than a month. Natasha Clark, RBC's political editor, has been at the press conference with John Healey. Natasha, obviously, when we heard that the Defence Secretary was holding a press conference, we might have assumed it is about Iran, but a reminder that the threats that Britain and the West is facing extend far beyond Iran's reach. And then, of course, Vladimir Putin, still a threat on our doorstep.
Yes, Lewis, absolutely. And the Defence Secretary was keen to hit back at some of the criticism that this government has been getting in the last few weeks over, I think, criticism from some parts that we were not ready, that it took a very long time for us to send a warship to the Middle East. He was keen to hit back at some of that today by saying, well, the reason why, partly why he was unable to sort of confirm exactly where our ships were, and of course we had that very awkward interview that he did with our colleague Nick Ferrari last week about that. He was keen to stress instead that the reason why is because we've been focusing instead on this month-long military operation in the high north, essentially just inside our European economic waters, but not actually inside our British territorial waters, slight differentiation there. But three Russian submarines carrying out a covert operation in the Atlantic north of the UK. He said that more than 500 British personnel were involved in basically getting Royal Navy submarines over there to basically say to these Russian ships, we see you, and basically get out of our waters. John Healey, speaking earlier in Downing Street today, explained to us what this operation was all about.
In the last few weeks, while the eyes of many were trained on the Middle East, the UK, in partnership with Norway and other allies, have responded to increased Russian activity in the Atlantic, north of the UK. This operation involved a Russian Akula-class attack submarine and a concurrent deployment of two specialist submarines from Gugi. That's Russia's main directorate for deep sea research. And last November, I outlined how these Gugi units, including the spy ship Yantar, are vessels directed by President Putin to conduct hybrid warfare activities against the UK and our allies, specifically around critical undersea infrastructure.
And John Healey had this message as well for Vladimir Putin.
I'm making this statement to call out this Russian activity. And to President Putin, I say, we see you. We see your activity over our cables and our pipelines. And you should know that any attempt to damage them will not be tolerated and will have serious consequences.
He said that one of the submarines immediately withdrew and that two others were monitored. He said that the operation left them in, quotes, no doubt that they were being watched. He said this attempted secret operation has now been exposed and they have now all left UK waters. Like I say, that message to Putin, which you heard just there, we see you and your activity over our pipelines. He said he believed that there had been no damage done, but his message was clear that if Vladimir Putin and his ships and submarines attempted to do anything to our undersea cables, which he, of course, have mentioned are vital for energy infrastructure, for internet connectivity, and of course receiving gas through our pipelines. He said there would be, quotes, serious consequences. He talked about the fact connection is everything beneath our waters. Our way of life depends on it. He said that increased attention on the Middle East and the conflict that we've been seeing in Iran has essentially given the Russians, given Vladimir Putin, a little bit of cover for them to carry out this military operation. He said, in response to that criticism, he was talking about when a crisis erupts, as it has done in the Middle East, the greatest threats are often unseen and silent. We must deploy to the best effect and step up to meet our threats wherever they are best needed. So an interesting press conference from John Healey, like I say, trying to hit back at some of that criticism. Of course, in the questioning afterwards, Lewis, he was asked about what's going on in the Middle East. I don't think he went too much further than we heard from Yvette Cooper, the Foreign Secretary, earlier today on trying to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and the work that the government are doing there on that. However, he was very clear that there should be no such tolls, no such paying for access to the Strait of Hormuz, as indeed Donald Trump has suggested he may be willing to do. And of course, Iran has suggested they may be willing to do as well.
Just briefly, Natasha, obviously we've seen the Prime Minister's in the Gulf. We saw the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper and out and about this morning. Very struck now by just how strident their language of criticism has become on the Trump administration and what is going on in Iran and on Israel as well. I mean, the Prime Minister asked yesterday about Trump's personal criticism of him. And the Prime Minister saying in explicit terms, I don't care. I mean, this is a world away from the approach to which he adopted to deal with Trump, basically for the first year of the Trump administration. It's quite extraordinary. I wonder whether they think at this point now they might try and yield whatever political benefit, given how unpopular the war is and Trump is in this country, they can, from just being explicit about how far apart they've become.
Yeah, it's a total U-turn, isn't it, Lewis, from how Keir Starmer and this government and this administration were trying to keep on Donald Trump's good side for at least the first year of Keir Starmer's premiership. But essentially, yes, you're totally right. This is, I think, they're doing this for political gain. They realise that Donald Trump is not popular. They realise this war is not popular. And for Keir Starmer, I think, you know, going into these crucial May elections, they are really keen to ramp up this idea that Britain may not be as safe under some other political leaders as they say it would be under Keir Starmer, and they are using that to their political advantage. That's why, obviously, despite the fact we're in recess, we are seeing from John Healey, we're seeing from the Prime Minister, we're hearing from the Foreign Secretary, and of course, there are very important things going on in the Middle East, and this government, I think, is trying to capitalise on that war and trying to use it for political gain to show voters, this is what you're getting with us, we are trying our best to keep Britain safe. But of course, it's a very hard line to try and toe by being out of the war, but equally, you've got the Prime Minister flying over to the Gulf, trying to sort of coordinate this sort of coordinated action to try and reopen the Strait. And of course, you're right, he can't rely on his relationship with Donald Trump anymore. That special relationship is very much being severed. You've got the President saying absolutely awful things about him on a daily basis. And John Healey, I thought, was quite measured at this press conference. He was asked, well, what about Donald Trump's Truth Social post that he's put out overnight? What do you think of his plans and what he said? And John Healey refused to get into it. But you have been hearing much more from the Prime Minister, from Yvette Cooper this morning, who I thought was very frank indeed when she was speaking to Nick Ferrari about exactly sort of what this government does think. And I think they are now holding him in a bit of contempt.
And just finally, Natasha, we can also see that even with regards to the local election campaigns of all things, the Iran war actually being an element of it. I note that Zach Polanski today, his campaign launch, talking about the idea that we need to put sanctions on Israel. This is foreign policy sort of dominating British politics in every single direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, John Healey didn't lean into that idea at the press conference. He did lean into the idea that we might be doing more on Russian sanctions. He sort of suggested that we've been doing quite a lot on that already, and he wanted to see that continue. But yes, absolutely. It seems like in the last few years, since Keir Starmer came in to Downing Street, with Israel very much a friend, with the US very much a friend, it feels like those two countries now grow very much more distant in the diplomatic realms of Whitehall from Keir Starmer's government.
Natasha Clark there, LBC's political editor, reporting live from Downing Street, where John Healey, the Defence Secretary, has been holding that press conference. And Liz Matter's defence that we're going to turn to after the news, picking up on that theme that I was talking about with Lord Ricketts at the start of the last hour about NATO. Is it still, can it still, in any sense, be a going concern? And if not, where does that leave us? It's just turned midday.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, the Defence Secretary John Healey has revealed that the UK has detected increased Russian activity in the Northern Atlantic. Three submarines carried out a covert operation lasting more than a month, recording critical pipelines and cables. There was no reported damage, and a warship and aircraft tracked the vessels until they left UK territorial waters. Speaking from Downing Street this morning, Mr. Healey had this warning for Moscow.
And to President Putin, I say, we see you. We see your activity over our cables and our pipelines, and you should know that any attempt to damage them will not be tolerated and will have serious consequences.
Mr. Healy also condemned Israel's attacks on Lebanon. As concerns grow, the Iran ceasefire deal could collapse. Iran has called Israel's airstrikes on Lebanon a breach, despite the United States insisting that it's excluded from the deal. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will continue attacks against Hezbollah, despite concerns it could destabilize the wider region. Noga Tarnopolsky is a freelance journalist based in Jerusalem and is following developments for LBC.
Politically, Netanyahu cannot do it. Netanyahu promised safety for the north, and as long as Hezbollah is operating in the south, even if it's not bombing Israel, which today it is, it's bombing nonstop, if it's just gathering its forces, if it's building up its weapons, he has not fulfilled a promise that is a political kryptonite for him.
Lebanese officials say more than 254 people were killed yesterday. The father of a 21-year-old student who died after being stabbed in North London has paid tribute to his son. Finbar Sullivan was attacked during a fight in Primrose Hill on Tuesday night. Christopher Sullivan has described Finbar as the most beautiful and loving boy, saying that he had no idea why his son was targeted. No arrests have been made. Officials in France say two men and two women have died after trying to cross the channel in a small boat. It's understood at least 42 people were trying to board the vessel when it got into difficulties this morning. A search and rescue operation is ongoing. And victims and bereaved families in England and Wales are to get more time to challenge sentences they believe are too lenient. The period to challenge an offender's punishments to increase from 28 days to 6 months. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 38 at 10,570. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather spells a rain will push eastwards, but staying dry in the south this afternoon. Any lingering rain will clear elsewhere to leave some sunny spells, a high of 23 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Way up here. Right at the edge of oxygen. In space. That's where you'll find us. O2 Satellite keeps you connected in more places than ever before. So even when you're far from everything, you won't have to miss a thing. Introducing O2 Satellite. O2. Essential for living.
30-day rolling add-on. £3 per month. Device type, app, location and other restrictions apply. See o2.co.uk/terms.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:04. I'm going to change our focus a little bit for the last hour of the show now and talk a little bit. I mean, it's very apposite to what we were just hearing from Natasha Clark, our political editor, being in Downing Street with the Defence Secretary, John Healey, reminding us that as we were going into this crisis, the Iran crisis 41 days ago, just as it is today, the primary menace to British security was not Iran, although Iran has been and looks like it will continue to be, perhaps a strengthened menace now, but of course, Putin's Russia. Russians at the gates, Russians are prosecuting a four-year illegal full-scale invasion of Ukraine, killing, slaughtering thousands of people, injuring, maiming many more, including, of course, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of their own citizens, young servicemen mainly, but also servicewomen as well, in the pursuit of pointless, futile territorial expansion. And, of course, President Putin, it is well known and understood that his designs, almost certainly, particularly if the war had gone better, do not stop and end at the gates of Kyiv. But instead, he has lamented, in fact, he has been clear in the past, that he saw the biggest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century, not as the Second World War, despite the fact that 15 million Russians died in that, more still, not what happened in terms of the Holocaust or whatever it happened to be. There was endless numbers of the catalogue that you could choose. But from his point of view, it was the collapse of the Soviet Union. And not because, by the way, he was particularly wedded to communism, but because he thought that the Soviet Union was a ballast against Western power. And there is no doubt whatsoever that the sort of things that he said about the Ukrainians not being a real people and a sort of group of people who are meant to belong within the Russian sphere of influence, he would apply to the Estonians and the Lithuanians and the Latvians and the Poles, possibly even the Finns as well, and other countries within Eastern Europe. And don't take my word for that. Take it from those countries and peoples of Eastern Europe who very much fear and think that. In that, of course, the primary bulwark of our defence has been NATO, as it has been now for the best part of 80 years, an organisation that the Attlee government, the Labour Attlee government, was instrumental in the post-war period in setting up. Donald Trump has long scorned NATO. He's long believed that it is pointless. He has long believed that it is comprised of the sort of deal that he hates most, one where he puts in more than he gets out. Now, we can take up the particulars of that and scrutinise them and so on, but it's almost irrelevant. That is what he believes. And he believes, and again, we can scrutinise the particulars because they're wrong, but it's irrelevant because it's what he believes. He believes that the Iran war has vindicated his view that NATO is a fundamentally lopsided, asymmetric organisation, that the Americans are there for us in Europe, but that we are not there for him. That is, of course, a historic Article 5, the self-defense clause of NATO, only ever initiated once, only ever triggered once in the wake of 9/11 by the Americans. Obviously, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of European servicemen and women perished in the wars that flowed from 9/11 and the appalling attack on America in 2001. But Trump either does not care or does not care to know and remember those things. And so he believes that his view has been vindicated. Mark Rutte, the Secretary of General of NATO, was in Washington yesterday to try to assuage Mr. Trump's anger that NATO members had refused to participate in the US-Israeli war in Iran, which, as I say, he believes has vindicated his view that this is a bad deal for the United States. Rutte, the former Prime Minister of the Netherlands, of course, conceded that it was not an easy meeting, calling it very frank and very open, which I think is diplomatic speak for apocalyptic car crash. This is CNN's Jake Tapper putting a question to Mark Rutte yesterday.
Is the world safer today than it was before the war was started?
Absolutely. Because, and this is thanks to President Trump's leadership, degrading these capabilities is really very important for your and my safety here in the US, in Europe, in the Middle East.
So that is Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, I think for reasons that we can understand, once again trying to get so close to Trump as he could almost sit on him, trying to say to Trump or saying to Trump that he was terribly wise and sagacious to launch this war that everybody with any objectivity can see has basically been a complete disaster. Now, Rutte, I'm sure, doesn't privately believe that, but he kind of has to say that, right? Because he's trying to mend some fences. He elaborated on why he thinks it's safer, as well as talking about his rather unusual personal relationship with Trump.
We like each other. I really admire his leadership, and he knows what he did in The Hague. Last year at the NATO summit has been crucial, and NATO allies are with him when it comes to the aims of taking out, as I said, degrading the nuclear and the ballistic missile capacity of the Iranians.
Yeah, but Europeans wanted to do it through diplomatic means.
Yeah, I know, but we run the risk that this would lead into the North Korea moment, where you talk so long that at a certain moment, it's beyond the point where you can still get this done, because then they would get their hands on the nuclear capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And that is basically a big risk for Europe. It is existential for Israel. It is existential for the Middle East. So the whole world is safer by this president degrading those capabilities.
The NATO Secretary General there, Mark Rutte, talking to President Trump. President Trump, not President Daddy, President Trump, about his personal relationship with the president and how they get along terribly well. Now, as we heard there, Rutte saying that the world is safer now than before the Iran war. I want to talk to you in this hour about whether you agree. 0345 6060 973. Is Mark Rutte right when he says that Trump has made the world safer? I asked Lord Ricketts, the former national security advisor in the UK under the Cameron government, in the last hour, whether NATO is still working. He disagreed with Rutte's assessment, by the way. This is what he told me.
Well, that's the point. I mean, NATO is a treaty, but it's also about trust, and it's mostly about trust. The treaty will still be there. NATO's got 10,000 people, civil servants, military people working in all kinds of headquarters and planning staffs. That will go on. But if the central trust is not there, if you can't be sure that America would be there, as you say, if Putin went into Estonia or somewhere, you know, then NATO, as a functioning vital organization is deeply damaged. And I think that's where we are, which is why all the Europeans, including the British, are now talking actively about much closer working together with countries like Canada, Australia, other middle-sized powers, because the fundamental trust that bound us together in NATO for 80 years is no longer there.
Just remember what Lord Rickard said there about trust, because it's crucial, I think, to this question of NATO, which I also want to get to. But before we do, I asked him about whether he agrees with Mark Rutter, which is our question for this hour of the show. Is the world safer now than it was before the Iran war?
No, I wouldn't. Rutter has his particular role as a kind of Trump whisperer, and I think he sees it as his mission to try and keep as good relations with Trump as possible. Okay, but honestly, I think he exaggerates there, and I don't agree with him.
So there's two questions for this. One is that question there. Is Mark Rutter right? Is there any world in which Mark Rutter, that we're just not seeing? I don't see it. But is there a world where beyond Mark Rutter just saying what he has to say to kind of try and grease the wheels, whatever is left of these wheels, which are no longer turning between Europe and the United States, does he just have to say that? Does he believe it? But also, is there any truth whatsoever in it? It is true that Iran's military capacities have been very significantly degraded. Not completely clearly, because if they had been, then we would be talking about a surrender rather than a negotiated peace. But clearly, that has happened. Is, as Mark Rutter said, the world now safer than before the Iran war, 0345-6060-973. But one way in which I think we can clearly say that the world is not safer is the second part of the question I want to discuss, which is about NATO. I think that anybody, and I think this has been true for a long time, I think it was basically true the second Trump took the oath of office and became the 47th president of the United States, and Biden left. I think there was a big question when Biden actually first came back in. There was a question about whether he was the restoration or whether he was the last gasp of something. That is Biden. I.e. a president who, to his core, to his bones, to his DNA, his political DNA, partly because of the age that he was born in 1941, he was part of the silent generation, he saw the aftermath of war, albeit not sort of around particularly at the time, but he saw that, and he just had an axiom, article of faith, that the European-American alliance was the linchpin, the pillar of American and European security. He just instinctively thought that, and he acted that way for all of his other frailties, quite literally. It was always a question about whether he was the last gasp of something, or Trump was. And I think it is very clear now that it was that Biden was the last of a particular type of president. And that Trump, yes, he's unique in lots of ways, but probably is an indicator of the way that American politics is going. We're not going to see more Bidens, because both the Democrats and Republicans, they might not express it as gratuitously as Trump, or as grossly as Trump, or offensively as Trump, but he does represent a trend. He does represent a trend, which is that the Americans are far less interested in Europe than ever they were. And American voters do not understand why they pay so much money, partly because no American president's ever explained it to them, partly because actually we have relied on them for far too long in terms of our security, and we haven't taken our own security seriously enough. But my contention to you, who seriously believes right now, we are kidding ourselves. We are kidding ourselves if we believe that NATO is a going concern. It's over. It's over for the remainder of the Trump presidency. Because NATO, as Lord Ricketts was saying, yes, it's a series of treaties, but what the treaties matter, they're just pieces of paper. You have to have the will to enact what's in them. NATO is basically a big confidence trick, and it has been for 80 years. It has relied on the then Soviets and now their successors, President Putin, the Russian Federation, to believe that on matters of security, every member state is indivisible from one another. Just as the United States is, out of many one, e pluribus unum. That is the idea behind it. And as long as they think that there's not a cigarette paper between each member state and our territorial integrity, that for this sake, for the sake of security, we basically have one common border, then the Russians won't touch us. And they never did. But the moment they think that there is a cigarette paper, and right now it isn't a cigarette paper, it is an absolute ream of paper, it is a gulf between the security of North America, say, and Europe, then we're vulnerable. And who seriously believes, is my view, who seriously believes that if President Putin tomorrow were to wake up and think, you know what, I think I'm going to expand this war a little bit and cause maximum confusion. I'm going to invade and on some spurious false flag pretense. I'm going to send in troops to quell minorities, you know, to protect Russian minorities. It's always minorities, isn't it? Going to go and protect Russian minorities in Riga or in Tallinn or in Vilnius or in Helsinki or wherever it happened to be. Who seriously believes that Donald Trump is going to use the American military to back us up? Can anyone say that with 100% certainty? 90%, 50%, 30%, 5%? And as soon as you're all at less than 100%, it's sort of over. And with each percentage point it goes down, it's over even more. And it's dead and buried even further into the ground and harder to exhume. Just consider what Trump said, truthed, just yesterday. And remember, this comes off the back of him complaining that the alliance had refused, down the barrel of a gun, basically, to hand over Greenland, which is European, Danish, NATO sovereign territory. NATO wasn't there when we needed them, and they won't be there if we need them again. Remember Greenland, that big, poorly run piece of ice? That's it. He sees it as a big piece of ice, and he feels completely vindicated that the Iran war has shown to him that he was right about everything all along, that NATO is simply an asymmetric deal, the sort of deal that he abhors. So who believes right now? Someone, please try and convince me, because I'd love to be convinced, because it scares me. It really scares me. Someone phone up and tell me why it is that NATO actually is still worth anything while Trump is in the White House. 0345-6060973. 0345-6060973. Mark Rutter, the Director General of NATO, says that the world is safer than before the Iran war. Is that right? The time is just approaching 12:18.
This is LBC.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper, to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato, and spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah!
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine, and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
At Wix, the Home and Garden event is now on. Save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £24, now £16. Shop today. Terms apply.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
Time is 12:19. Obviously, the way in which President Trump is wrong to attack NATO for all of this is to say that it is somehow NATO's fault for not backing him up. But of course, NATO is a defensive alliance, rarely an offensive one. You can talk about what happened in Kosovo in the 1990s, but generally speaking, it is not an alliance where just because one member of it says jump, everyone else says how high. You have to be attacked first. And Trump, of course, was the attacker, the aggressor, the one on the offensive in Iran, which is the difference with Ukraine and the difference with what's been happening in Europe, which, although Ukraine's not a NATO member, clearly affects security. Want your view. Is NATO now just a paper tiger? It exists legally, but in any real sense, it no longer exists. 0345-6060973. Ali is in Northampton. What do you think? Do you think Mark Rutter's right, the world is safer or not? Good afternoon,
Absolutely
Ali.
Absolutely not. Thank you very much for having me on your show. Enjoy it.
Good.
Thank you very much. Well, just to say that he is completely wrong. He is actually facilitating a bully who's going around making the world 10 times worse, lawless, and no international law. The whole point that United Nations came about and international law came about to try and make the world safer. But this bully has not made any sense by attacking Iran or Venezuela, taking out its president. He's literally working on his impulsivity and impulsive. And thank God that Iranians have stood up to him, taught him a lesson. and that he is stuck in his the mud.
Well,
and thank God that thank God the British Prime Minister didn't facilitate him as much as he wanted. He just did absolute minimum to try and make Britain a bit safer.
Well, we shouldn't be terribly happy, should we, Ali, that the Iranians might emerge this more powerfully than they were before. The Iranians are no friends of the United Kingdom. The Iranian government, I should say.
Well, I mean, they've literally been the reports, security reports from the United Kingdom Parliament say there were no threats to the UK.
Well, I don't know about that, Ali. Security services.
Well, you can type it in,
Ali,
Google, mate.
Ali, check what the security services have said over many years, indeed decades. Iran has been a long-time sponsor of state-backed terrorism, including in the UK. So that's not true.
Yeah, but the point that you're making about the NATO alliance, first of all, this was pointed out yesterday that if there was any threat inside the UK, they should take them to court, put them into prison, and let the courts deal with that. That's point one as far as threats against the UK is concerned. As far as the NATO is concerned, this gentleman, head of NATO, should be standing up to him, try and protect, you know, European countries and NATO nations and against a bully, because he's literally driving us into a lawless international world, which literally, I mean, the next thing we know, there'll be Third World War.
I suppose, Ali, if you're going to defend Rutter, and I'm sure that Rutter...
I'm not defending him.
I'm going to defend him for a moment, just for the sake of the argument. Rutter, you know, a distinguished statesman, a distinguished politician, you know, he's Prime Minister of his country in the Netherlands for a long time. I think over 10 years. You know, I'm sure that it sticks in his craw to have to publicly suck up to Trump so much. But I suppose, you know, calling him daddy and all that stuff. But I suppose, you know, the justification in his mind will be, look, my job is to try to keep this alliance, which has been the linchpin of European security and North Atlantic security for 80 years. And if that requires me...
Well, he's already
opted out. Go on.
He's already opted out of NATO.
Well, I mean, that's the question. I mean, he hasn't formally, but the question, I suppose, is as soon as he's positing it and publicly allowed wondering about it, that it's sort of over already.
Yeah, but you see, what Europe should be thinking about their relationship, seriously thinking about their relationship with the United States, because the United States is no longer capable or able or willing to protect Europe.
Yes.
Europe has become so vulnerable that literally this man, whatever you want to call him, is literally pushing the whole world towards a Third World Order. That's what he's not international law, a lawless society. I mean, if someone nicked a car in the US or, you know, damaged someone or killed someone, they'll be executed. But he's prepared to go around the world and kill thousands of people, take people's oil, as he did with the Venezuelan oil, and bully people. What about if he came to the Scottish Islands and he said, you know what, you've got North Sea oil, we're going to get troops there. Who's going to stop him?
Do you feel safer than you did before the Iran war?
Absolutely not. 10 times worse. I live in the UK. I've lived here 47 years. I think the worst that this man could do to the United Kingdom. He is not, you say, he's making UK any safer. I tell you what, he's 10 times worse a threat than Iran has ever been. He's got a track record of being unsafe, attacking countries. For all I know, if he attacked the UK, you know, there's not a thing UK could do about it. The same as he wanted to take over Greenland. The same as he's taken over the president of the Venezuelan president because he wants oil. What did he say about Iran? I want to go there to take down their oil, the Karg Island. Well, go there.
Mate,
see
leave
what
the
happens.
Impressions to me.
Huh?
I said, leave the impressions to me, pal. All right, Ali. Grateful to you, Ali in Northampton there. Mark is in Annick in Northumberland. Mark.
Good morning.
Afternoon,
it's
I think.
Good afternoon, isn't it?
It's morning somewhere. It's morning. I tell you what, Mark, it's morning in Washington, and we are awaiting the first missive from Truth Social at any moment.
Yeah,
so the president will doubtless just be waking up now, stretching his arms. The phone will be reaching it over. What mad stuff
please,
I'm going to say this morning.
Don't depress me anymore than I'm already depressed. You know,
there's always Classic FM. No, I shouldn't say that. Keep listening to LBC, obviously.
Yeah, I listen to that at night.
Right, okay.
So anyway, I think NATO is a busted flush. I think that Rutter shouldn't have gone over there. It was a mistake when he called him daddy. And I do respect Rutter as a politician.
Sorry, it's just so funny we have to say that, isn't it? It was a mistake when he called him daddy. What timeline are we living in?
Yeah, I know. But let's talk about some serious stuff. So I think if he can hold NATO together, let's say for a couple of years as an organisation, and it is hanging by a shoestring right now.
Yeah.
But we need to rethink this as a European entity. That is us. Unfortunately, we are outside of Europe as, in terms of the EU. But if we look at what we could do and what is possible, and one of them I would say is that we need to have a European version of this. I don't know, call it UTO, and draw a line down the centre of the Atlantic and say, this is our responsibility. And you know what, Mr. America? That's yours. We have more than 1 million men already in uniform in this on this continent, and I include ourselves in that. We need to rethink about the nuclear capability. We don't need two nuclear powers in Europe. We've got two right now, France and the UK. If we or France decide, well, actually, if we're going to have a nuclear power, it would be would have to be France. Because they have the capability and the control of their own missiles.
Yes, they've got a truly independent force, the force de frappe.
We don't. We can't launch our missiles without American codes behind them. And they maintain all the missile systems on the submarines.
Well, the MOD say, of course, that we could do that. But over time, we obviously rely on them for components and so on. It's operationally independent, but over time, probably wouldn't be.
Yeah, and that's true. And we did have operational independence back in the 60s and the 70s, but we don't have it now. So let's be clear about that. The Poles have completely re-equipped their army. It's probably the biggest army in Europe right now.
Yeah.
And probably the best equipped.
And they're spending about 4 to 5% of GDP on their military in order to do it.
Now, the bug in the apple for us, and this is a hang-up of the UK military, the proportion of money that we spend on nuclear defence outweighs everything else that we can spend on conventional defence. So maybe, you know what, maybe all European countries that were members of, let's call it UTO, contribute to the French to have a nuclear deterrence, and then we redeploy all the money that we've spent on a nuclear deterrence. And I'll tell you now that the chiefs of staff within the UK MOD really don't, particularly the RAF and the Army, don't like the disproportionate amounts of money that's spent on the Navy for a nuclear deterrence.
No, no, they would love, they would dearly love to have them. And do you think that, Mark, though, we are, I mean, I completely agree with you. What we should be using this as an opportunity in Europe to think seriously about what new institutions we need, because no institution, you know, NATO was founded 80 years ago, it was very effective during the Cold War. Maybe now that is not the right vehicle for European security. You know, out of every crisis, there is an opportunity. We need to be thinking really creatively and imaginatively about what new institutions we might require and how we might need to back them up in terms of military spending. But I don't really get that sense yet of any of that truly happening.
Yeah, but the, one of the problems is everybody's, and it's sort of fueled by, I'm going to say this, by the right-wing media, is, oh, the sky is falling down and everything is a disaster. Well, right now, the circumstances are not perfect, and they're not. But, you know, we should look on this as an opportunity. Let's reconfigure, let's rethink. Well, you know what, there are some of the brightest men in the world in our military across Europe. And some of the brightest politicians, it just needs some rational thoughts and stop panicking. We don't, right now we need the US marginally. We will survive without them. And we can grow up and we can look after ourselves, and it's time to bite the bullet and reconfigure.
Mark, in beautiful Alnwick, up in Northumberland, just listen to this. This is Caroline Levitt, that's the press secretary to Donald Trump, of course. She was speaking from one of her regular briefings yesterday, and she was asked a question about the future of NATO.
Can you tell me, is the United States still considering withdrawing from NATO? Is that still a possibility?
It's something the president has discussed, and I think it's something the president will be discussing in a couple of hours with Secretary General Ruta, and perhaps you'll hear directly from the president following that meeting later this afternoon. Thank you, everyone.
She went on to say that, as far as the president was concerned, NATO had let down the United States. I can see Lorna saying, for goodness sake, how many times? Do some research. Trump or any other president doesn't have the power to leave NATO. It needs a huge majority, one-third or two-thirds of the vote in Congress, which Republicans haven't got. Also, both parties in Congress are pro-NATO. Two things to say to that, Lorna. One is, increasingly, actually, in American politics, on the Democrat and particularly the Republican side, even in the grassroots level, it's increasingly the case they're not pro-NATO. That's number one. I agree with you that they wouldn't have the numbers in Congress. But he doesn't need to formally withdraw from NATO. He is the commander-in-chief. All he needs to do is cast enough doubt on the idea, which he's already done superbly from his point of view, that America would honour a treaty obligation, an Article 5 invocation. Or he just says, commander-in-chief, well, I don't care what the treaty says. When push comes to shove, I'm not going to deploy the military to defend them. And there isn't a great deal that Congress could actually do, or certainly would be willing to do, given how utterly supine it is, or would have the numbers to do, to compel him to do so. He ultimately leads the executive branch and has huge discretion over what he does as commander-in-chief with the military. So he doesn't need to formally withdraw from the treaty. It's a complete red herring. Let's get the latest news headlines now at 12:31 with Tim Humphrey.
Iran says Israeli strikes on Lebanon are a grave violation of its ceasefire deal with the US. Cracks in the agreement are beginning to show barely 24 hours after it was agreed. The defence secretary has warned about increased Russian activity in Atlantic waters north of the UK. John Healey says he directed the military to track Russian submarines in a recent mission. Officials in France say two men and two women have died after trying to cross the channel in a small boat. It's believed at least 42 people were trying to board a dinghy when the current swept them away. LBC weather, spells of rain pushing eastwards, but it will stay dry in the south. Rain clearing to sunny spells and showers later. There could be snow on high ground in the north, a high of 23 degrees.
This is LBC. Ready for a new kitchen? Wix kitchen experts can support you with clever designs and a professional installation. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine, and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
There it is, her suspicious face. She doesn't believe you. All you did was tell her your shirt was chenille. She said, "What's chenille?" You said, "Dunno, but you do know it feels chic." And so does she. She felt it for almost too long. Then you gave a twirl to show off the fit. She nearly spat out her croffin. You deliver the final bombshell. It's from Primark, only 14 quid. Surprise is served. Shockingly chic for £14. That's so Primark. Available in-store and on click and collect.
Do you ever feel like getting back under your duvet in the middle of the day? Ferroglobin is a great-tasting liquid formula with iron, which contributes to the reduction of tiredness and fatigue and normal formation of haemoglobin. Ferroglobin from Vitabiotics at Boots, pharmacies and vitabiotics.com.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
Time is 12:33. Want to continue the conversation with you about whether you agree with Mark Rutter, whether the world is safer after the Iran war. Do you feel safer, even in the UK? 0345 6060973 in his NATO busted flush. First, though, I want to sort of bring this home a little bit. Just we talk so in such a blasé way sometimes about sort of the effects of this war, and we talk about how many people are displaced, over a million people displaced in southern Lebanon alone. But of course, behind those numbers are real stories of real people. Professor Ahmed Hankir is a consultant psychiatrist based in London. He's British Lebanese himself, has families in both Beirut and Saida in Lebanon, and they've been under heavy bombardment by Israel. Professor, thanks so much for joining us live in the studio this afternoon. Just tell us about the situation with your family and the plight that they're currently facing. Obviously, not combatants in the war, ordinary civilians.
Yeah, civilians. My father is a retired physician, obstetrician. He worked for the NHS for over 16 years. Diligently, takes great pride in contributing to British society. And at the moment, I would say we are deeply concerned, deeply distressed. We thought that Sidon, Saida, which is the capital of the south of Lebanon, was relatively safe. But unfortunately, yesterday, the day of horror. Sorry, Lewis, my nervous system has been activated. So
please, Professor, do not for a moment apologize. I completely understand. Please just take your time.
Thank you. So we got the WhatsApp notification that Lebanon, Beirut, Saida, other locations throughout Lebanon were under constant bombardment. There was this huge sense of relief when the ceasefire was announced, but shortly afterwards, the Israeli military launched their airstrikes over 10 minutes, 100 airstrikes, and it has been dubbed the day of horror yesterday, and today it's officially a day of mourning. So the attacks have wreaked havoc on our nervous systems. We are on high alert, hypervigilant. Fortunately, physically, they are unscathed, but I'm sure you can appreciate psychologically, we are distraught.
Your family, and obviously there's been over 1 million people displaced from southern Lebanon. Are your family among them, or are they still able to stay in their homes?
No, at the moment, my parents, because my father has health issues and mobility issues, it's not so straightforward, and there's a lot of congestion, as you can appreciate, and pandemonium. And so at the moment, they are in the south, in Sidon. But as you rightly said, 1.2 million people in Lebanon have been forcibly displaced. That's the largest number of people in Lebanon's history. And you mentioned at the start, we are human beings. 254 people were killed yesterday by the Israeli military. Can you imagine if the same happened in Israel? They would be outraged, and rightfully so. And it just feels like we are not getting that same global reaction, outrage, and that we are, to a degree, being dehumanized. And I condemn the killing of all innocents, irrespective of their background.
How old are your parents, Professor?
My father is in his 70s, and my mother is in her late 50s. I have a sister in Beirut, in Hamra, which is West Beirut, in close proximity to the American University of Beirut Medical Center. And very recently, the Israeli military bombed a location which was only 100 yards away from where my sister currently lives with her husband.
Leaving aside all of the geopolitical forces that are rocking the region, it must just be hellish for you every single day. You must be absolutely racked with worry.
Thank you for asking, Lewis. Obviously, I'm a consultant psychiatrist. I've always embraced my vulnerability. I've always been honest, open and transparent about my own mental health experiences to combat the stigma. I identify as a wounded healer. I was avoiding the news and the notifications because in 2006, when I was a medical student at the University of Manchester, when the Israeli military attacked Lebanon, I experienced a mental health crisis, and I don't want to go there again. So I was deliberately avoiding the news. And I said to myself, this time I'm not going to be sensitized, but me and like many other members of the diaspora, we feel guilty. Like, why is it that we're here? I woke up this morning, I'm in Crystal Palace Park, and it was peace, it was tranquility, it was serenity. Meanwhile, my people are suffering, and not just my people, the people in Gaza, people all over the world. And you do feel guilty. And it does, as I said, wreak havoc on your nervous system. It's continuous traumatic stress, Lewis. It seems like it will never end. It's relentless. It's ongoing. And this is a trauma response. We're on high alert, and we're hypervigilant, as I said.
And the stress for your family as well. I mean, the anguish for that must be appalling.
Yeah, I mean,
how are they doing?
Well, my parents, they know how I react, even though they are at the epicenter, and I'm not the victim here, far from it.
Well, you are, really. I mean, indirectly, but you are.
Vicariously, yeah. Thank you, Lewis. But my parents are at the epicenter of what I would call our atrocities. Many people are calling these crimes against humanity and a violation of international law. Certainly disproportionate, and I would say not justifiable in the slightest. But they want to remain resilient, stoic. They know how I react, but they can only wear the mask for so long, and that mask is it's slipping off, and you can discern how devastated and distraught they are. Not just them, but many other people throughout Lebanon throughout the world.
Do you have? I mean, Israel obviously says I've been to southern Lebanon. I've reported from there. I've seen Hezbollah there. They are absolutely interwoven into the cultural fabric, the community fabric of southern Lebanon. They run southern Lebanon. The Lebanese government, for all sorts of reasons, has not been able, and some say willing, to remove them. Do you understand the Israelis, to any extent, the Israeli government's position, who say they have security problems? Even today, Hezbollah are firing hundreds of rockets at northern Israel, and that they have to try and take care of their own citizens.
I think both sides of the border, there are security concerns. People in Lebanon will say that their neighbors in the south are a security concern, and people in Israel will say that their neighbors up north are a security concern. I think,
but Hezbollah, of course, in Britain, at the very least, it's a proscribed group.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Terrorist group.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And I want nothing to do with Hezbollah. Yeah. I don't condone them in the slightest. On the contrary, I condemn them in the strongest possible terms. And they have carried out atrocities and heinous and horrific acts. And I want to distance myself as far from them as possible. But I think, the Israeli military are contributing to the current hostilities in Lebanon. You can argue disproportionately as well. And like I said, there is international law that must be abided by all parties, by all entities, by all nations, by all organizations.
Their argument, of course, is very similar to, as we heard in Gaza, that Hezbollah, like Hamas, they say, choose to locate themselves in areas of, densely populated civilian areas.
Yeah.
Do you accept that?
So, unfortunately, the Israeli military has targeted densely populated civilian areas, resulting in widespread destruction of civilian infrastructure and the killing of innocents. And, I do not condone Hezbollah in any way, shape or form. I condemn them, but I don't think that necessarily absolves the Israeli military. They are ultimately dropping the bombs, and there is this element of agency as well. So I think that's, to look at it through a psychodynamic lens, that's almost like externalizing and not taking any responsibility or accountability yourself.
I think you said before, are you concerned that southern Lebanon might become another Gaza?
Of course, when you hear that, it's horrifying, Lewis. That was the comment, I think, that really struck me the most, when an Israeli official said, almost, I don't know, in a way to brag or to boast, that southern Lebanon will be turned into another Gaza. Of course, that's horrifying, and that's nothing. I don't know what that even means. What does that even mean? Is that something to be proud of? I think that should be a source of deep shame. It's not me. These are not my words, Lewis. The UN has described what's happening in Gaza as a genocide. Human rights organizations in Israel have described what's happening in Gaza as a genocide. So to hear that, it sounds genocidal to me, and that's concerning. These are not my words.
No, I know. I understand, and of course, I should say, obviously, the Israelis continue to deny that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide.
I understand
I suppose in terms, I mean, you must, as British Lebanese yourself, I mean, you mentioned going back to 2006, I said earlier in the show, I was a student in 2006, I remember the Lebanese war then, and I sort of almost sort of pinched myself that was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I suppose, I mean, being Lebanese yourself, it must, and for Lebanese in the region, and Israelis in the region as well, who, you know, have no animus towards Lebanese and vice versa, this just must feel so endless and exhausting and an endless cycle of violence in which, as I did put to the Israeli government spokesperson earlier, you were a psychoanalyst, it does feel so often like the Einstein definition of insanity, you know, keep doing the same thing over and over and over and again, expecting a different result, which is violence.
No pun intended, right? Sometimes an appropriate response to reality is to go insane, right? And it's a mad world we're living in, Lewis. But, I mean, it's not me. I think these are the, whoever you want to call them, the military analysts. I think they themselves say there isn't a military solution here. I don't think you're going to disarm, you know, Hezbollah militarily.
Or Hamas.
Or Hamas, absolutely. Again, or the Iranian regime or whoever. But I personally, and it's not my area of expertise, I don't think there's a military solution. I think we should return to diplomacy. And I want peaceful coexistence for all. I have friends who live in Israel. Some of my closest friends who live in Israel. I even call him my spiritual father. He's a Jewish man who is from Israel. He's currently in Wisconsin. We wrote two textbooks together, one about anti-Semitism and psychiatry, and the other textbook about Islamophobia and psychiatry. So I do have Israeli brothers and sisters who believe in a peaceful coexistence.
And we should say, for people not familiar with Lebanon, despite all of its problems, an astonishing country, or wonderful country it has been in the past, to visit, certainly when I've been there. And of course, people, this is not one of the most ethnically mixed and religiously mixed countries anywhere in the Middle East. It has a confessional political system, partly to deal with the fact that it has so many different religious groups and religious minorities that have to be represented in the parliament and so on. This is not a case, I mean, inevitably, what I'm trying to say is that there will be lots of people of lots of different religions and ethnicities who are caught up in these attacks.
Very much so, very much so. And you remind me of Robert Fisk and his magnum opus, you know, Pity the Nation. He was quoting the mystic Lebanese poet Khalil Gibran. And it's more than just a pity, isn't it? But you're absolutely right. You know, it's ethnically eclectic, it's diverse, it's progressive, it's inclusive, and it's a sorrow that weeping cannot symbolize, to quote John Steinbeck, what's happening at the moment. And, you know, I just want for peace to prevail. Call me an optimist if you must, but I just want the hostilities to end and for peace to prevail.
Would you like your parents to come to the UK?
Oh, with all of my heart. it's not up to me, but people say this. People say, why don't your family leave?
Not easy.
No, I mean, especially when you become at home, when you become at, why doesn't the conflict end? Why don't the atrocities come to an end? So, of course, with all of my heart, I want them to be here, but ultimately I have to respect their you know, their agency and their opinion and their views and their independence. But, I mean, it might come to that.
Do you think the peace will come to Lebanon one day?
Well, I mean, I pray for peace. I pray for peace, not just in Lebanon. I pray for peace in Israel. I pray for peace in Gaza and throughout the world. And again, like I said, you know, call me a hopeless optimist if you must. But, you know, the killing has to end. The atrocities must end.
Well, optimist or not, I like what I hope you're right. Professor Ahmed Hanke, a consultant psychiatrist based in London, British Lebanese himself, as we've been saying, and has family in Beirut and Sidon in Lebanon, under heavy bombardment, as so many others, by Israel. We're going to continue this conversation about whether or not Mark Rutter is right and the world is safer as than it was before the Iran war. I certainly doubt they feel that in Lebanon. Time is 12:46.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Why do you think Israel continues to attack in Lebanon? Are you bothered by ministers taking short holidays now? And four more die in the Channel. Where does it leave Anglo-French cooperation on boat crossings?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Looking for a new kitchen that you can't wait to come home to? Wix has over 80 kitchen styles, from ultra-modern to timeless classics. And options for every budget, with kitchens for first homes and forever homes too. So book your free kitchen design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wix.
Bring your pensions together with PensionBee and take control of your retirement. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
At Lidl, there's always more to value. Like switching from Morrisons to Lidl and saving £40 on this week's big shop at lidl.co.uk/save. Which means a stocked up fridge of big brands, award-winning own brands, and your fresh value a day with extra helpings encouraged. Lidl, more to value. Prices check 7th of the 4th, 26. Morrisons also sell other products. See online for more details.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Sava, founder of Cool You, the daddy of air conditioning. For over 15 years, Cool You have specialized in installing our fully internal aircon systems throughout London with no mess, no fuss, and no external condenser. And from April the 10th to the 19th, come and meet me and the team at the Ideal Home Show, London Olympia. Cool You for a cool, comfortable home.
Here's a bright idea. Let Wix see how much you could save on your electricity bills. With Wix Solar, our team handles everything under the sun, from design to the perfect installation of your solar panels. We're proud as a peacock to be rated excellent on Trustpilot, so you can feel confident your solar installation is in safe hands. Book your free solar appointment today at wix.co.uk. Wix Solar, a name you can trust with service you can rely on.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
Time is 12:49. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has confirmed that IDF strikes in Lebanon have killed a nephew and Secretary of Hezbollah leader Naim Qassem. In a statement on X, he said that his nephew was one of the closest people to the militant group's leader. He added that the Israeli military will continue to strike Hezbollah wherever necessary, a day after deadly Israeli airstrikes on Lebanon. Also worth noting that according to the UN Refugee Agency, more than 30,000 people have crossed the border now from Lebanon into Syria in the past 72 hours alone. Remember how many refugees Lebanon themselves absorbed from Syria during the Syrian civil war. I think at one time a quarter of Lebanon's population were refugees. Such a troubled, troubled part of the world. Our heart, of course, goes out to all of the people, as we were hearing there from Professor Hankes, for his family and so many others like it. Innocents on both sides of the border caught up in this endless spiral of death and despair. Richard is in Finsbury Park. Richard, got something to say about NATO, I think, good afternoon. What have you got to say about this?
Hey, Lewis. Yeah, well, it's providing narrative that NATO is in trouble and is finished. I think it can be challenged, because certainly if you compare it to what the Americans have done with the Iranian invasion, the Iranian war, where they're negotiating. But my point about NATO is that we can actually argue that NATO is effectively helping Ukraine to win the war with Russia, because American support is now negligible. Putin was hoping to make a big advance this year with his spring offensive, and it's in complete tatters, Lewis. They're losing about 1,000 soldiers a day, and there's a good chance that they won't have the whole of the Donetsk region. They've got about they wanted to seize it all. They've now got about 75%. So there's a good chance if Ukrainians carry on with the progress they're making, that they'll actually lose most of Donetsk, and that's happened only because of NATO weapons. For instance, the Greeks have given Ukraine 60 very good artillery pieces, which means that the Ukrainians are for the first time winning the artillery war. So
is that Joe, I hear what you're saying, Richard, and actually I think one of the unreported stories of the last few months is actually the extent to which Ukraine is doing far better in the war than was commonly assumed even say 6 months ago.
Yes.
But is that so it's a total agreement with you there, but is that a slightly separate thing in a sense that yes, of course NATO has been in terms of some of the military infrastructure and so on important to the Ukraine war effort, but it's distinctive, isn't it, from the collective self-defense of NATO, which requires a belief that all members will honor it. So our efforts to supply and help the Ukrainians is separate from that, isn't it? And that's kind of what we're discussing.
But I think the reality is what we've seen over the last couple of years, certainly, and certainly recent weeks, is the decline of these two superpowers. Russia, Lewis, is now a country that doesn't really have an army anymore. They're recruiting sort of 40,000 conscripts every month, most of them being chewed up. They have no navy, and they're scared to fly their planes over Ukraine. So there's no way in the world that Russia can threaten any NATO country anymore. That's big. And we've also seen the limitations of American power. They thought they could bomb Iran into submission within days. And now they're negotiating. So I think we're seeing the tectonic plates of the world shifting quite radically. And the two previous superpowers are much weaker. And what you hear from America now, I'm sorry, but they're all sounding rather desperate, aren't they?
I think you're absolutely right to say that what the Iran war and Ukraine war, and there are some interesting parallels, obviously very different conflicts, but there's some interesting parallels between the two. I think what they're definitely showing, is that they are salutary lessons for great powers, which is that I think there is something about modern warfare, which although these, you know, have enormous sort of militaries at their disposal and so on, but with, you know, emerging technologies, drones and the rest of it, that actually, you know, even relatively lesser powers can end up sort of bogging you down, and that your power isn't quite as great as you think it is. So I definitely think it changes potentially the risk calculus, and Ukraine is basically our best card, really, in terms of keeping the Russians bogged down there. They are fighting basically on behalf of all of us. But again, do not think that the question of the collective self-defense, it's unquestionably far weaker than it was under Joe Biden, isn't it?
I guess my answer to that would be that we now know, if you look at the sort of 20 or 30 NATO powers that have supplied Ukraine with kit, Lewis, French tanks, German tanks, anti-aircraft stuff, I think NATO, this is one of the strange things. If you listen to all the sort of headbangers, they'll say, oh, NATO's finished and Starmer's let us down. They're misunderstanding. NATO, all I'm really saying is NATO is a lot stronger than we think we are, because we've got very good conventional forces.
Well, maybe Europe is stronger than we think we are. Richard, grateful to you in Finsbury Park. I want to get Samina in, who's in Tooting, in glorious South London, of course. Samina.
Hi, Lewis. So I wanted to make the point that the US-Israel war on Iran has not made the world safer economically. And if you just allow me to make some points, and then I'm happy...
I'll tell you what, Samina, we've got a bit of a dodgy, crackly line all the way in beautiful South London, unfortunately. Our technology clearly doesn't extend to Tooting. So we'll try and fix that and go to Kieran in the meantime, who's in Bracknell in Berkshire. Kieran, hopefully we can hear you a bit more clearly.
Yes, Lewis. Thank you for taking my call.
Not at all.
First of all, let me applaud you for what you're doing. You're a breath of fresh air in showing a better journalism than most of the people in the mainstream media.
Well, thank you very much.
And I love your impressions of Trump, so please do continue and expand it.
I think they're going to be banned. I think Eleanor's going to ban them tomorrow, but never mind.
Yeah. Saying that, I want to make a slightly different point. I want to say NATO is dead. United Nations is dead.
Right. A nice uplifting way to end the show.
Sorry?
A nice uplifting way to end the show.
Yes, because the world has stayed silent when all these three bullies are dealing with it. When I say three bullies, Putin, Bibi, Trump. We had, in 1930s, there was only one person. And fallout of the Second World War, we have all these organizations which has come about. We can clearly see the deficiencies of all of these organizations. We have a spineless Mark Rutte who stood up yesterday and said that the world is better because it is stroking the ego of this bully, right? And it is time that we rethink the entire world peace. When you hear the stories of this professor and all the, it is the humanity which is dying. And the world leaders are allowing it to happen.
But wasn't Mark Rutte just doing what he has to do,
no.
Kieran, which is just try and keeping the show on the road and greasing the wheels insofar as they can be greased?
I mean, Churchill will be turning in his grave. We have enough issues with the, in his leadership itself. But the point is, if you don't stand up for the bullies and allow it to happen, he has done it with Venezuela, he's talking about Greenland, he's talking about Cuba, he's talking about everywhere.
Okay.
We're allowing this offensive operations.
Okay.
What we are talking about, what we need, Lewis, is a new United Nations.
Oh, wow.
Permanent Council, the United Nations Security Council, cannot keep vetoing of this. Any conflict in the world, every single nation on this planet should vote and make a decision.
All right. Kieran, grateful to you. I suppose almost by definition, though, if you've got a secondary United Nations, not really the United Nations anymore, the disunited nations. Samina, I think, last word to you. I think we've got you back on a better line in Tooting.
Yeah.
Samina,
yeah.
What did you have to say?
Yeah. I was going to say that the world has not been made more safe economically. There's massive energy supply disruptions, oil price surges, massive risks of stagnation for the world economy. Now, just in shipping, insurance, aviation sectors have been massively disrupted. What does that mean for us? You know, even in the energy facilities and infrastructure in the Middle East is going to take a good few years to recover.
Yes.
Global shipping is. What does that mean for us? Food insecurity, financial
yep.
insecurity, social cohesion. It'll contribute to political instability worldwide.
Yep.
And you've just mentioned refugees, Lewis, yourself. Potentially there's a refugee crisis on the horizon. And what does that mean for us as a country? Inflation is going to stay high and interest rates are going to stay high. And that will mean that our government doesn't have enough to invest in upgrading weapon systems. So if anybody wants to blame anybody for making us and the world poorer, blame Israel for duping Trump into an easy war and whispering in his ear for 6 years. Oh, yeah, by the way, China will be richer, yeah?
Yes, I think that's probably right. Samina, you had the last word. A lovely uplifting way to end the show there. But hey, what else could you expect? If you missed any of today's show and you want to listen to this optimism-a-thon once more, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the LBC app, where you can also stay, of course, up to date with the latest news, nightmares, horrors, videos and opinion. You can also listen to a range of podcasts, including the News Agents, which I'm off to record right now, and Lewis Goodall Daily. I think it used to be known as James O'Brien Daily, but I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I don't quite remember
Terrible.
The guy.
Terrible.
Best bits from the LBC show every day. I've got chuntering from a sedentary position from the honourable lady in the corner there. Download the official LBC app for free. Order, Fogarty, from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick. Now it's time for the very rude lady, Sheila Fogarty, very rude person.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Listen, am I wrong to think it's okay for our Defence Secretary and Prime Minister to take a little holiday? Not going to the North Pole on a hike or climbing the Himalayas for weeks on end and being out of contact. I think this stuff is all puritanical nonsense. We'll talk about that a little later. Much more seriously, 4 people, as you know, have died attempting to cross the Channel from France, the same week in which France rejected greater cooperation with UK Border Patrol. Where does all this leave us on so-called stopping the boats? But I'm going to start with that ceasefire that you've been talking about as well. Can the new and fragile ceasefire hold? And why do you think Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu is still attacking in Lebanon?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the Defence Secretary has accused Russia of trying to damage vital infrastructure in the North Atlantic. John Healey says British armed forces tracked Russian submarines for a month, and he had this message for Vladimir Putin.
We see you. We see your activity over our pipelines and our cables, and we will not tolerate any attempt to damage what our way of life and our modern way of life depends on so much.
The operation involved a frigate, planes and hundreds of personnel alongside help from allies. The Russian vessels have now left. Iran has halted shipping in the Strait of Hormuz in retaliation for Israel's strikes across Lebanon yesterday. Tehran claimed that breached the terms of a US-Iran ceasefire deal, but the Americans say Lebanon was never part of the agreement. Laura Ricketts, a former national security advisor, told LBC he's not surprised after what he describes as chaotic negotiations.
Messages being passed through the night between some Americans and somebody on the Iranian side via the Pakistanis. No agreed written text, as far as I know, and therefore lots and lots of ambiguity about what was agreed.
Officials in France say 2 men and 2 women have died after trying to cross the channel in a small boat. It's believed at least 42 people were trying to board a dinghy when the current swept them away. A thief who stole a handbag containing a Fabergé egg and watch set valued at up to $3 million from a pub in London's Soho has been jailed for more than 2 years. 29-year-old Enzo Conticello took the bag belonging to Rosie Dawson as she stood in the smoking area of the Dog and Duck pub in Bateman Street in November 2024. Conservationists are warning emperor penguins face becoming extinct. It's being put down to a loss of sea ice as the planet gets warmer and a smaller availability of food. Separately, British cod is being taken off the sustainable list due to pressure from climate change and overfishing. It could see prices rise if the UK has to turn to Iceland or Norway for supplies. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 26 points at 10,583. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.50. The LBC weather, spells of rain pushing eastwards, but it will stay dry in the south. Rain clearing to sunny spells and showers later. There could be some snow on high ground in the north and a high of 23 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Humphrey.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. My sense yesterday, and I know many of you shared the same sense, is that the continued military attacks by Israel on Lebanon, which we'll get to in more detail in a few minutes, would be the biggest sticking point in this ceasefire, this new and very fragile ceasefire that's been agreed between Iran and the US and Israel. The reality is, I think, that Benjamin Netanyahu couldn't do anything but go along with the Iran bit of it, because it was so America contingent, that. But Lebanon and Hezbollah and Israel, in Benjamin Netanyahu's mind, I think, are a very different order of magnitude, or a different matter altogether. I mean, the Prime Minister of Pakistan very much disagrees. We'll get to what he's been saying in just a moment. But essentially, Israel has launched the largest wave of strikes in Lebanon in this particular war so far, killed more than 250 people. Yes, amongst them many Hezbollah commanders, but civilians as well. And of course, there's that huge displacement of Lebanese people out of the south of their country to the north to try to avoid the missiles that are incoming. The Israeli military said it hit 100 targets in just 10 minutes. So you can imagine that onslaught. And we had a call yesterday from somebody who'd been speaking to a friend in Beirut, and in that call, she could hear, I think, probably that onslaught, the way she was describing it. When the ceasefire was announced, this is what the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Shehbaz Sharif, said. He said he was pleased to announce that the Islamic Republic of Iran and the US, along with their allies, have agreed to immediate ceasefire everywhere, including Lebanon. So he included Lebanon and elsewhere, effective immediately. He went on to say, I warmly welcome the gesture and extend deepest gratitude to the leadership of both countries. And went on to say the kinds of things you would expect a broker of peace to be saying. Benjamin Netanyahu tweeted last night, so at the end of the first day, really, of this ceasefire, we still have objectives to complete. We will achieve them either by agreement or by resuming the fighting. So, in a sense, giving a similar kind of ultimatum to Hezbollah that that Donald Trump gave to the Iranian regime, although in rather less fruity language. Donald Trump, for his part, on Truth Social early this morning, was back up to his usual tricks. All US ships, aircraft and military personnel, additional ammunition, weaponry and anything else that's appropriate and necessary for the lethal prosecution and destruction of an already substantially degraded enemy will remain in place. So we are staying put, essentially, which is echoing what Pete Hegseth said yesterday. Until such time as a real agreement is fully completed, complied with, sorry. If for any reason it is not, which is highly unlikely, he says optimistically, then the shooting starts, as he puts it, bigger and better. And on he goes. He talks about the opening of the Strait of Hormuz as well. No nuclear weapons, he says. The strait will be open and safe. And on he goes. So this is the picture right from the beginning of this announcement that we got in the early hours of Wednesday morning, that Israel disagreed right from the off that Lebanon be included in the ceasefire. This is what J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president, said of the ceasefire. He said it was focused on Iran, not Lebanon.
I think this comes from a legitimate misunderstanding. I think the Iranians thought that the ceasefire included Lebanon, and it just didn't. We never made that promise. We never indicated that was going to be the case. What we said is that the ceasefire would be focused on Iran, and the ceasefire would be focused on America's allies, both Israel and the Gulf Arab states. Fundamentally, we're on the right track. We got a lot more to do. We got a lot more that the Iranians are going to have to accept as part of this negotiation, but I think we've got a strong hand, and we're going to play it well.
So it was J.D. Vance. Our own Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, says she's extremely concerned by the developments in Lebanon. She was talking to Nick Ferrari at breakfast this morning.
It's also the wrong thing to do for stability across the region and security for Israel as well. We want to see this ceasefire extended to Lebanon. We want to see an end to hostilities in Lebanon urgently. It's extremely important that that happens.
Well, in a press conference just a couple of hours ago, the Defence Secretary, John Healey, stated the UK, echoing her really, stated the UK wants Lebanon be under the ceasefire deal.
We welcome the ceasefire. We want it to hold. We will do our bit to try and strengthen it. We condemn the escalation in Lebanon. We want the Israel-Lebanon conflict to be brought within the terms of the ceasefire, because we want to see greater stability return to the whole of the Middle Eastern region.
Well, Alex Scandler, a spokesperson for the Israeli embassy in London, told Lewis Goodall on LBC earlier on that they will act in a different way to European cities, European capitals, because their neighbouring nations want to cause them harm, plain and simple.
Right from the beginning, that Lebanon